It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Saru Yaraman, co-founder of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United, are going to be here talking about the minimum wage. And, you know, the fact that for tipped employees in this country, the minimum wage is $2.13 an hour, that is just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, going back to when I was in college, I mean, it's been that long since the minimum wage, I think, has gone up for tipped employees. They keep kind of brushing over those folks. Well, you're making tips. You know, I remember girls that I dated back in college who worked as waitresses. Whatever the wage they got just went right away to taxes. They never saw a paycheck. They just walked out every day with money. And at the end of the year, had to chip in a couple of bucks even more because even back then, as I remember it, it wasn't enough to cover just their taxes. So it'll be interesting to talk to her about that. Nicole Wu, director of the domestic policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, going to be here talking about the New York Times article on this this shift away from safety net programs benefiting solely the folks who are in poverty to, well, the majority of us. Especially the folks in the working class who have seen their wages stagnate, who have seen their income go down over the last, well, 30 years as the attack on workers and the assault on unions have moved forward. So we'll talk about that. Also, Carla Walter, senior policy analyst at the Center for American Progress Action Funds, the American Worker Project, going to be here talking about Mitch McConnell's statement that, well, you know what? Employers should be able to decide what kind of health benefits their employees get. And you know what? If the employer decides that you can't have contraception, well, then that employer can decide that. I think I have a little different take on it. I'm hoping that Carla Walter does as well. And in the third hour, John Threlkeld from the American Federation of Government Employees Legislative Department going to be here talking about the Down Payment to Protect National Security Act of 2012. Remember we talked about this at the beginning of the month. The Republicans said, well, you know, we failed at that whole super duper super secret super committee. We didn't do what we were supposed to do, figure out how to cut the deficit and cut some of our debt problems. So we're not going to do anything. And that consequence for failure, which were these triggers, well, we're not going to abide by that either. We agreed to it, but we've kind of changed our mind. So it'll be interesting to see from the workers' perspective, federal workers' perspective, where they stand on this. Now, I understand the Republicans want to pay for this by gutting federal employees and freezing their pay from now until forever. So it should be an interesting discussion. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Questions, comments, something on your mind, give us a call, or you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So the big news, the budget came out, a very different budget from Obama than we saw from Corbett. Very different in its Vision, very different in its direction looking forward as opposed to a budget that Corbett put forth looking backwards. How do we take us back 100 years in education? How do we cut, gut, and punish on the state level? The president has come out and said, look, you know what? We need to create jobs. We need big transportation bills. We need to get people back to work, create jobs. And you know what? Start taxing the very wealthy people. It is a $3.8 trillion budget. They're saying it's going to be just over a trillion-dollar deficit. And again, you know, I look at this and I go, that's why we should be raising revenue. Should have been raising revenue all along. Those Bush tax handouts should have ended a couple of years ago. But again, we had people who caved. But if you look at this, you know, they're saying the budget assumptions could mean that unemployment somewhere around 6% until the year 2017. Some are saying, well, that's overly negative. Maybe you were a little too pessimistic, Obama administration, because you had some decent job numbers, some better than expected growth. Maybe that's gonna change. I'll tell you what's not gonna happen. What's not going to happen is unemployment is not going to come down if we continue to put Republicans in power who keep saying we need to cut, gut, and punish. We're not going to create jobs. We're not going to grow this economy if we continue to say, well, we need to cut spending on education and infrastructure. We need to not invest in our future. I'll tell you right now, the predictions of 6% in 2017 will be rosy if we get a Republican in the White House in November. I'll tell you that right now. Guarantee it. Mark it on the calendar. He wants to spend some $50 billion on roads and railways and airport runways. So, again, a little bit of money, not enough, but a little bit. He wants to fund modernizing some schools, about 35,000 they're talking about. He also wants to invest $8 billion in community college to, you know, train people, do what the community college system was invented for, get people job training that they need for jobs that are going on right now. Some of the downsides of it, you know, I can hear the righties going nuts now. He's going to cut Medicare by $364 billion. They're going to take some of the profit motive out of it. Again, get rid of that for-profit insurance that they concocted. That Medicare Advantage, which was beautiful. The right wing, it's just beautiful how they did that. We're going to give seniors a choice, and we're going to give them a whole bunch of extra benefits, and there's going to be all kinds of good stuff for them, and they're going to all rush to it. About 25% of the people on Medicare ran over to it. Three-quarters of the people stayed on good old traditional Medicare. And do you know what the numbers are? And this shocked the heck out of me. The people who went over to the Advantage, to the for-profit side of it, the 25% of them cost more to insure than the people who were stayed in the traditional Medicare, the 75%. So you have 25% costing more than 75%. That is Republican world. And they put that in there specifically to destroy the system. Divide, conquer, much like they're doing with education. I mean, it's not no real surprise. It's what they do. So, again, you've got this Medicare, another example, just like the schools here. We have a for-profit charter school in there. They get their money first. They get their money, you know, as guaranteed a couple of years back when rates were higher. So they suck all this revenue out of the public side of it. Who suffers? Well, the public side of it. And that's exactly what's happened to Medicare. And it's a good thing that he's closing that for-profit side of it down. He's also going to take some heat over $226 million that they're cutting from NASA's robotic exploration program. Times are tough. I wish we could keep, I'd like to keep it. I think a lot of the things that we get from the space program, research, good stuff. He is asking Congress to back the Buffett rule, which, as we've talked about in this program, 30%. I think it's reasonable. It's what the alternative minimum tax was supposed to be. But that, you know, you've had all these rich people with the money to lobby, and they keep passing fixes, and they keep doing all this stuff to make sure that it never goes up. So that's a good thing, 30%. He wants to repeal the Bush handouts for the very, very wealthy, and, of course, keep the breaks in there for folks making $250,000 or less per year to keep stimulating the economy. What I would do is I'd flip it around. The money that we were handing out to the Buffetts and to the Gateses and to the Romneys, I would give it to the people at the bottom. This way you spur demand. You spur customers. You get people out there with a little cash in their pocket, a little jingling going on. Get them into the stores, generating activity. He is also calling for a financial crisis responsibility fee. And I'm in favor of this. Go after the banksters we bailed out. They're fat and happy right now. They're doing well. They should help. They should help fund it. We're going to be talking about the budget throughout the day. I just thought I would throw that out as the big news. I don't know if you saw over the weekend, though, CPAC had their big conference. Lots of big news out of there. But, you know, the one thing that I think most people that just kind of flew by people is the Marriott Wardham Park Hotel there in D.C. is a union hotel, represented by Unite Here, Local 25. And again, you know, if you truly believe that, you know, unions are bad and union workers are bad, wouldn't CPAC go specifically to make a political statement to a non-union hotel? Maybe they understand. Service is much better. The quality of worker, a little bit better. Maybe. Anyway, the Romney, he picked up the win there at CPAC. Some people are saying maybe he cheated. Who knows? He also picked up the win in Maine, and Ron Paul is saying that, well, he may have cheated. Santorum, all upset that Romney may have bought a couple of tickets. So that again, you know, I look at this, and it's kind of funny when someone like Santorum turns around and says, well, you know, you got Ron Paul who won the CPAC thing for years, and that was just because he bought a bunch of tickets and trucked in whole bunches of people so they would vote for him. So he paid their way, you know, bus tickets and all the whole. He said, we would never do that. We don't do that. We don't rig straw polls. And you know, as I heard that, I go, does the name Bob Vanderplaat mean anything? Anybody remember that? The guy who is the president and CEO of the Iowa-based The Family Leader. Anybody remembering him buying their endorsement? Anyone? Because I kind of remember there being a whole scandal around that. That, you know, this Vanderplaat was out there trying to hawk their endorsement because he knows he's got all of these people on a string, and if they give the endorsement, they're going to follow along. Kind of interesting. So, you know, what I found pretty amusing is that this Candy Crowley asked him, somebody's telling you that they think Mitt Romney's team paid for folks to go and vote for him in the straw poll? And he said, well, that's the standard procedure of all these straw polls. The campaigns that want to win go out and recruit people and provide free tickets for them to come out and vote. And I guess he doesn't want to win. And I saw that. I go, well, the campaigns that want to win, they do that. I guess he doesn't because he's broke. And if you look at the money behind the vest, you know, a guy who's, you know, struggling financially, he's got to go find money where he can. And where do you go? You go to multimillionaires. You go to the big bucks. And the guy who's been funding him up until recently is this guy named Foster Freeze, who long history of being an Islamophobe, a long history of funding those kind of groups. What I found interesting about him, And I had read something about him. He had given a speech, basically preaching to the kids at a commencement at Pepperdine University to be more intolerant. You know, he said, there's a group of people, maybe secular, Taliban is a good name for them, who have morphed this idea that you have to accept my values being every bit as cherished as your values. He says, that's not tolerance. He says, there are too many things in this world which we sit back and tolerate. And you know what? There's part of me that agrees with him. Every time I hear these right-wingers tell me how pious they are and how wonderful they are and how their religion is so much better and their God is better than my God and all of this stuff, it kind of makes me go, yeah, I'm being intolerant of these idiots. Then there's the other part of me that says, they're just idiots. But this is an idiot with a lot of money because he's funded Walker and Kasich and the whole lot of them. So big money there. And I guess he set up Tucker Carlson and his website, The Daily Caller. So this is where the big money comes from. It's all about pushing that message, which they do pretty well. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We're right back after with Sari Yaraman from the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. Right back after this.
Something as simple as rock and roll would save us all.
Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Los Angeles Unified School District officials are considering plans to cut funding for all adult education. The move will have a detrimental impact on 300,000 students throughout the city who rely on the program for courses in the English language, basic education, and job training. Leilani Albano has more on the story.
When Elena Mikhailieva arrived in America almost 2 years ago, she didn't speak much English. But with the help of instructors at Evans Community Adult School in Los Angeles, she's made major strides in her language skills. Mikhailieva is among the 300,000 adult education students who are taking English language and basic education courses. Adult school programs also help struggling high school students earn credits towards graduation. And many students say it's helped make positive changes in their lives. But that may come to an end due to a plan by the school district to scrap adult education. Mikhailieva says cutting adult education is a bad idea.
It's so important to know English and to have well-educated people in America.
Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent John Daisy announced plans last month to stop the $120 million of funding for the Division of Adult and Career Education. The annual allotment goes towards 30 adult education campuses. Adult school classes are also taught in thousands of K-12 campuses, churches, and other spaces throughout the city. The classes offer a wide range of courses that include culinary arts, auto repair, nursing, landscaping, electronics, graphic design, and computer programming. Opponents of the cuts held several demonstrations so far, including an action on February 8, where protests were held on 10 campuses. The cuts will have the biggest impact on poor and immigrant communities in Los Angeles, who have benefited the most from adult school programs. Shutting down classes may have an economic impact, too. Matthew Kogan, chair of the Adult Education Committee for the union United Teachers Los Angeles, says the cuts will only worsen the city's ongoing crisis.
Los Angeles already has a large undereducated population. I think it'll make an already divided city economically more divided.
Superintendent Daisy says the district has few options but to eliminate adult education as a way to fill the district's $540 million shortfall. He says it's either that or the district will be forced to cut preschools, elementary school arts, as well as thousands of administrators, teachers, nurses, cafeteria workers, and custodians.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Do you advocate getting rid of the minimum wage? Would that create more jobs?
Absolutely, and it would help the poor, the people who need a job. The minimum wage is a mandate. We're against mandates, so why should we have it? No, it would be very beneficial.
Everything's raising but the wages. Everything's raising but the wages. Gasoline grosses and our haces. Everything's raising but the wages.
Now, as I've been saying for the longest time, and you listen to the Paul Botts and the other ultra-conservative pro-business types, and you know it's all about destroying the minimum wage. It's all about destroying what little labor protections we have in this nation and taking us back to the good old days of the 90s, the 1890s. This idea that we have a permanent desperation class, you know, people who are willing to work for, you know, maybe just a loaf of bread. But we did learn. I mean, I think, you know, there's part of me that thinks we learned that during the Great Depression, that will work for food wasn't low enough. And that's why you needed to have a floor under workers' feet. I mean, it's mind-boggling me that anyone would even consider voting for someone like Paul. But it is what it is. Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So like last week, we talked about in Florida, this Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association urging their legislators in the state of Florida to slash the state's minimum wage. Florida, to their credit, has a $4.65 minimum wage for tipped employees. Now, the federal minimum wage, $2.13. And I think that's where Pennsylvania still is right now. And a lot of places across the country haven't seen an increase in that. I don't know, 20 years? Probably more than that. That's why I've asked Saru Yaraman to come and talk to us. She's the co-founder and co-director of ROC, Restaurant Opportunity Senators United. RockUnited.org is their website. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. So, Ruth, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I look at this story in Florida. You got this woman who's the head of this this group making almost $500,000 a year advocating for a cut to the minimum wage for tipped workers, for waiters, waitresses. It makes almost no sense to me.
No sense. And the irony of it is that they proposed it almost to the day that the National Restaurant Association released its 2012 forecast projections, which indicate that they're projecting $635 billion in revenue this year, which is a record high and a 4% increase from 2011. And they're also predicting that 1 in 10 Americans by the end of this year will work in the restaurant industry. So they're predicting record high profits and at the same time proposing to slash workers' wages.
Well, I mean, this is just more of the no rights at work agenda at work, this whole redistribution of wealth from people who actually work to people who, well, don't.
Absolutely. $2.13, as we've seen among our thousands of members around the country, is not enough even to buy a loaf of bread, as you talked about at the beginning. It's not enough to eat, and it's the reason that servers, the people who serve our food in America, actually use food stamps at twice the rate of the American workforce. They can't afford to eat. And that's an outrage.
That is an outrage. And as I remember, the $2.13 an hour, you don't even get a paycheck. That pretty much goes straight to taxes. And then you end up kicking in more money for taxes.
That's right. Many of our members across the country get $0 in their paycheck, can't afford to pay the rent. Many are homeless. We're talking about 10 million workers. We're not talking about a small workforce. We're talking about one of the biggest workforces in America with the absolute lowest wages in America. And most of these tipped workers are women. Two-thirds of tipped workers in America are women. So we're talking about mothers who are trying to put food on the table for their families.
Well, do you think that's part of the problem? I'm looking around here the last couple of months and the assault on women's rights. They can't be more blatant about their disdain for women having rights. And I can't imagine that higher wages for them are something that's on the right-wing agenda.
Absolutely. The report that we just put out today says that whereas in most industries, the pay gap of women earning 70 cents to the dollar to a man's dollar is a matter of employer discrimination, in our industry, in the restaurant industry, it's a matter of law, because there's a law that says we pay a third of what regular everybody else pays to tipped workers for $2.13, and that's where women are concentrated among tipped workers. The law says we will pay less to women. In fact, we will pay these $2.13 wages.
It's an absolute outrage. And if you want to find more information on what Rock United does, you can go to rockunited.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Saru's name. And you can actually take action there by clicking on the Take Action button there at their website. You know, and I look at this, and you see, so as you've said, this is a huge industry. And so many of these people who are doing these jobs are working mothers trying to put food on the table. And, as I've been thinking about how this attack on our social safety net has come down, it's a direct attack on these women, especially because they're out there working. They're out there busting their behind, and their wages haven't kept up. Their wages can't afford to put food on the table. So we have safety net programs that have helped them, and we see these attacks constantly.
Yes, and it's purely an issue of political will and political force. The National Restaurant Association, actually led by Herman Cain in 1996, struck a deal with the Democrats in Congress saying that they would not oppose a rise to the regular minimum wage as long as the tip minimum wage stayed frozen forever. And it's been 21 years that the tip minimum wage has not risen from, $2.13. So we've got workers in our industry who've worked in the industry for more than 20 years. Their wages have not gone up, but they've seen the industry grow by leaps and bounds and bring in record high profits. So you've got these huge multinational corporations. We've got a campaign right now against the world's largest full-service restaurant company, the Darden Restaurant Group, which owns Olive Garden, Capital Grille, Steakhouse, Red Lobster. This company brings in $1 billion in profit a year and pays its workers $2.13, which means we, the consumers, are the ones who end up subsidizing workers' wages in this industry, and that's just not right.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you go back to what this article said about from this Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. Her assessment of the minimum wages, it was just killing them. It was just killing the employers. They just couldn't possibly, under any circumstances, bear the weight of $4.65 an hour. And I'm going, really? If that's the case, I don't know that you really belong to be in business. But I'm hearing you.
It's absurd. When you've got the Miami restaurant industry thriving and growing, and we just put out a report on the Miami restaurant industry last year, which shows that it's growing by leaps and bounds. And we've got other states in the nation. California is the largest restaurant industry, is a state with the most restaurant workers of any state in the union, and has no lower minimum wage for tipped workers. It's the same for all workers. L.A. is the city with the largest restaurant industry, bigger than New York, thriving, growing industry with a minimum wage for tipped workers of above $8. I mean, that just shows you it's possible, it's doable, it's not going to hurt restaurants. It's an absurd argument.
You know, as we lose manufacturing in this country, a lot of the jobs, you know, and I remember back in the 80s, Reagan talking about being a service-based economy, getting rid of all that dirty industry, and we're just going to be a much cleaner, white-collar society. And the jobs that they envisioned were exactly the ones that we're talking about now. Guess the discussion back then was never, can we actually live on those jobs, and can you support a family doing those things? And I say, you know, the answer to all of this is, well, unionizing.
Yeah, organizing for sure. Workers organizing in whatever form they can to build power for themselves, to build power in the industry, to counterbalance the power of the National Restaurant Association.
And that's what you guys do at the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United, correct?
Yes.
Can you tell me about it? And you're the co-founder, co-director. Why did you start it, and what are you guys doing?
So shortly after September 11th, we came together with the workers who lost their jobs at Windows on the World, the restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center, and started to provide support to workers after the tragedy, but were very quickly flooded with workers from all over the city, New York, and then all over the country with cries for help. Everything from low wages, wage theft, lack of benefits, discrimination, you name it. And so we've grown into a national restaurant workers organization with about 9,000 members in 19 cities. And we engage in campaigns against exploitation, as we are with the Darden campaign. We also promote what we call the high road to profitability, partnering with responsible employers that are doing it right, providing good wages and good benefits to their employees, and actually opening our own worker-owned restaurants called Colors. We have two cooperative restaurants in New York and Detroit. We're opening up a third one in New Orleans. And then we do a lot of research and policy work. We've been working with Congresswoman Donna Edwards on the Wages Act to raise the tip minimum wage to 70% of the regular minimum wage. We've also won a number of policy victories at the local level to increase standards for restaurant workers across the country. We've got a lot of programs for members, so restaurant workers that are listening can go on our website, become a member, get training, get support. We do a lot of free programs to help workers advance to livable wage jobs in the industry. And we're all about building power and voice for workers to counterbalance the power of the National Restaurant Association.
You know, you hit on something that I think is vitally important. Ownership is so important, and I'm a huge fan of cooperatives, and I'm a huge fan of worker-owned facilities, and I wish there was something like that in our area.
We're definitely happy to work with workers anywhere in the country to look at our model and expand it. We definitely, part of what we're trying to do is to show that workers actually can lead and you know, have the skills to own their own restaurants as well.
And not even so much, you know, lead it, but, you know, you're still doing the work, but sharing in the rewards. I mean, you don't have to have a high-paid CEO to run a successful business. You have to have successful people and people who want to participate. And I'm a big fan of the model of, you know, you're still going to have a boss, and you're still going to have a hierarchy, but everybody's involved in it. It's really a very community thing. That's, you know, being from Cleveland, that's just the model that they've done for some time, and I like it.
Yeah. Well, the key is the more invested your workers are, the more well-treated they feel, the better The better they feel invested in the business, the better business you're going to have, the better services you're going to have. That's just true across the board, cooperative or not.
Right. Do you promote the good actors, the good restaurants? I mean, is there a place where, you know, I can go if I'm going to New York or Washington or somewhere where you go, hey, I'd like to go to one of these restaurants, you know, to patronize the good actors and maybe stay away from the Dardens and the negative ones?
Absolutely, yes. We've just put out the National Diner's Guide, which is a guide that includes the minimum wage, paid sick days, and internal mobility policies of the 150 most popular restaurants in America. Almost all of them are chains. It also provides information for 35 what we call high road employers around the country who've won awards in the guide for their minimum wage, paid sick days, and internal mobility practices. So we encourage people to pick up the guide. You can get it on our website. Check out tomorrow's Valentine's Day, the highest grossing day in the restaurant industry of the whole year. And so in terms of choosing a restaurant, definitely support those high road restaurants. But if you find yourself at any one of the others, just, you know, we encourage consumers to start the conversation. Let employers know that a minimum wage of $2.13 is not acceptable. Not having paid sick days is not acceptable. And we as consumers, we don't just care about making sure the strawberries are organic or that the chicken is free range. We also care to make sure that employees are treated well because it affects our health. When workers don't have paid sick days or are homeless because they can't afford the rent, it affects us as consumers as well.
Excellent.
We need to let the industry know when we eat out.
And maybe write on one of those little cards that they leave at the tables and let them know. Again, rockunited.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Saru Yaraman, co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United. We've got a link. Just click on her name. It'll take you right there. Saru, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Let's take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick Santorum is the latest darling of the most extreme of the GOP's extremist voters. And wow, get an earful of this guy's moral piety. Let's start where it all starts for us humans, conception. Not only does Santorum insist that life begins at the instant that a sperm contacts an egg, he also wants to preserve the sanctity of the sperm itself by outlawing birth control. Yes, every sperm counts. Last October, he warned about, quote, the dangers of contraception in this country. It's not okay. It's a license to do things in a sexual realm that is counter to how things are supposed to be. Indeed, Ayatollah Rick is a bit obsessed with what you might be doing in your bedroom. The Supreme Court, he asserts, was wrong to rule that we have a right to consensual sex in our homes. Then you have the right to bigamy, he wails, the right to polygamy, to incest, adultery, the right to anything. Then comes his punchline, this right to privacy doesn't exist, in my opinion, in the United States Constitution. In a January interview on CNN, the sanctimonious Santorum offered another startling insight into his moral code. When asked what he would say to his daughter if she had been raped, was pregnant, and was crying for an abortion, he actually said, the right approach is to accept this horribly created, in the sense of rape, gift of life, and accept what God is giving you. He added that his daughter, and presumably yours too, ought, quote, to make the best out of a bad situation. This is Jim Hightower saying, so much Rick, so little time. I haven't even gotten to global warming. No such thing, he says. Or his endorsement of the Crusades as being about, quote, core American values. Or his comparison of homosexuality to man-on-dog sex. But with Santorum now in the spotlight, we can count on many more Rickisms to enlighten us.
Need an antidote to the progressive blues? Want some good news about how grassroots folks are rebelling against the corporate powers and winning? Well, here's an easy-to-swallow pill for you, the Hightower Lowdown. Hightower's monthly newsletter will give you the lowdown, even as it lifts you up. It's 4 pages a month, jam-packed with facts you can use, actions you can take, and Jim's own Texas humor, all for only $15 a year. To become a lowdowner, go to HightowerLowdown.org or call 1-866-271-4900.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast from the website, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. So my favorite quote today comes from Paul Krugman, who writes, tinfoil hats have become a common, if not mandatory, GOP accessory. And, yeah, pretty much so. Anyway, you know, talking about the New York Times, I came across an article this morning that just, it's one of those things where you go, as I'm reading through it, I'm going, yeah, this is exactly why I started this program. It was titled, Even Critics of Safety Net Increasingly Depend on It. And it goes through and it's talking about, you know, small shop owners. It's talking about, you know, these conservatives in this, this small town in Minnesota, who depend heavily on government programs. They depend on, you know, the earned income tax credit. They depend on food stamps. They depend on Medicare. They depend on Social Security. All of the things that government has put under our feet, they depend on. And the right wing in this country is just livid that it's there, because they want, as you know, as Ron Paul said in the beginning of the last segment, do away with it, and it all collapses. Then we have this desperation class where we can then really exploit people. And you know, I go back to when I started this program. And I can tell you the day I decided that something had to happen. A guy lived in my neighborhood, nice guy, and you'll never hear me say a bad thing about him. Super nice guy. In fact, you know, I had been away, and it snowed really heavy, and he came over with his plow, and he plowed my driveway so my wife could get out with the kids. Just a great guy. Except politically. And I remember that day when he plowed the driveway, I went over to thank him. And, you know, he took me for a tour around his house, and we started talking. And turns out he had retired, Teamster like me, he was retired from the freight industry. Had spent like 40 years collecting a nice pension. He had Social Security, bought his house with a VA loan. He had Medicare. His wife was off on disability, Social Security disability because of a repetitive use injury. So, you know, all of this stuff, all of these New Deal programs, all of this government in his life, and he turns around and tells me he hates government. And there's a huge picture of George W. Bush on the mantle. And you go, where's the disconnect? And even his wife says, you know, he spends too much time watching and listening to Fox News and just inundated in that world where he's constantly beaten with it. The Limbaugh, the Hannity, the whole nine yards all day long. Constant beratement, constant in his ear, constant, you know, pushing their ideas. And I decided that, you know, there's nothing on the other side. There's nothing that I can find in this area that would say, you know what, there are other people out here. Nothing I can find at all. So that's why I started this whole thing. Because, you know, it's important to have both sides of the story. So I look at this, the safety net that's under our feet. And they talk about this guy who's a small business owner, who owns a logo apparel shop. And he's never made, makes like $30,000, $39,000 a year. And he says, I don't want any government help, but he takes it, tons of it. His kids get, you know, federal lunch program money. They get Medicare for his mother. They get the earned income tax credit, which is a huge subsidy. In fact, you're talking about almost like $6,500 for each man, woman, and child in the country in 2009. These programs, a 69% increase from 2000. So in this community where this guy lives, almost a dollar of every, one in every $4 comes from some sort of benefit program. So the community is heavily vested in this. And what I find amusing is they turn around and they badmouth it. Say, well, you know, we can't raise taxes. And they have this kind of self-loathing that, you know, at one point they need it. They can't survive without it. In fact, the guy they talked to about Social Security and Medicare, he's like, you know what, I had heart surgery twice. And without it, you know, I'd be dead. But he says, you can't keep asking for people to do everything for you. And as you're reading through this article, I'm thinking, man, this article is right on, except the part where wages haven't kept up. We've seen a massive redistribution of wealth. We've seen the wealthy in this country walk away with huge amounts of government largesse. And they give us pittance. And the thing is, I've met numerous people who rely on government assistance, and they feel bad about it, ashamed. And society does that. And we're at a point right now where we're almost half the people in this country are getting some type of need. And it is getting worse because we're seeing wages going down. We're seeing more jobs leaving the country. And Republicans have really seized on this moment. They've seized on that guilt, that remorse, to go after the programs and make them the cause. It's the program that's the cause. It's not the real problem, which are stagnant wages, the massive redistribution of wealth from us that work to them who sit on their behinds, and this boom-bust free market policy that they've continually rammed down our throats. Understand, it was the Bush recession and the bad responses to those recessions that really caused the massive deficits and the debt problems, not government programs. You go back to the Reagan years, it was the excessive spending, it was the boom busts that happened then that we responded to poorly. I mean, you stop and you think about unemployment and food stamps and WIC programs and all of the assistance programs that help folks on the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. Without those policies, without those programs, this country right now is in a depression and spiraling deeper and deeper into that depression. And I can't understand how you can come up with this idea that, well, we need to cut spending, and somehow that's going to create jobs. The reality is, no matter how many times you tell me, Rick, we're going to cut spending, we're going to cut education and healthcare spending, we're going to cut transportation spending, and somehow, magically, the job fairy is going to go, you've done a nice job cutting, we're going to put jobs on you. No matter how many times you say it, it's not happening. Never. Never, 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 not even clinically, is that ever going to happen. And for me, you want to talk about what the solutions are. It's about getting people back to work in those jobs, paying a living wage. You know, the more I sit back and I think about it, maybe Uncle Milty had the right idea. And I think about Milton Friedman from time to time. As far off the deep end as he was, I think, he did have a couple of good ideas. And what one of them was is the basis of the earned income tax credit. That all working people, they have some consuming potential. And it was his mind that you had programs through the tax code that would give each person $6,000. So a family of four would have a minimum of $24,000. And they would spend that however they wanted. And he had a formula that you encourage people to go out to work. And for every couple of dollars, they would take one away. And it was a formula that the more you made, the less you got. So if you were making $70,000, $80,000 a year, of course, you got none of the $24,000. Because you were making beyond what the $24,000 was. But everybody had some spending ability. Everyone had the ability to take care of themselves and to support themselves, put food on the table, a little roof over their head. You know, the things that we all go, well, we probably should have. Which is the basis of this earned income tax credit. And I was surprised, you know, to learn that, you know, there are people who get it who say, well, I don't really want it. Like the guy in this article saying, well, I don't really want it. And if you look at Census Bureau numbers, almost half of the people in the country received some type of government benefit in 2010. That is way up from 1998, which you just had 37%. And, you know, why is this the case? You know, why are we seeing more people ending up in the roles of the poor? Because these programs were supposed to be for poor people, not middle-income folks, not people who own businesses. You know, why is this the case? Well, stagnant wages, for one. And why is it that we have stagnant wages? Pretty simple. We've had a massive attack on working people. We've had a massive attack on unions. And really an all-out assault on workers who want to try and organize. And what I found interesting is back in 1975 when they came up with this earned income tax credit, it was about 27 grand a year. That was the limit. Now it's up to almost 50. Because what we're doing is we're supporting low-wage employers. Think about that. Think about how this props up the low-wage employers. And the idea, understand what the idea of the earned income tax credit is. It's to keep low-income workers in the job force. You know, at $2.13 an hour, the waitresses and waiters who bring you your dinner, you know, basically are at your mercy for whatever it is that they're going to be able to feed their families with. They're propped up by this earned income tax credit. So one way or another, we're always going to pay. It's just a matter of how you get it and do you have some respect in it? And, you know, I'm just amazed at how this whole discussion about what government does has gone and attacked government instead of saying, well, you know what? It's saved us from a massive, massive depression. It saved my grandmother's life. It saved my life. Isn't that what we're supposed to be doing together? I mean, isn't that part of the whole reason we form government? Now, there's some bad things, absolutely. And you deal with those. But you don't tear down the house. But that's what the righties would want us to do. And that's what they would want us to think. Which is why we have to stand up and fight back. You know, in Minnesota, the one school district that they pointed out, this North Branch School District, they decided that, you know what? We're not going to raise taxes. We don't have the money. We're going to cut school back to 4 days a week. Can you imagine that happening here? Because I can. I can see it coming. And then three, and then two, and oh, by the way, never mind. Just send them to the factories. Send them to the mills. I hope it doesn't come to that. Anyway, quick break, right back after this.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Evidence announced in early 2012 suggests that today's dogs might have originated from more than one ancient ancestor.
Scientists found a 33,000-year-old dog-like skull in a cave in Siberia. They compared it to equally ancient dog-like remains from a cave in Belgium. The researchers from the University of Arizona said both the Siberian and the Belgian skulls came from domesticated dogs rather than wolves. Wolves have long, thin snouts, and their teeth aren't crowded. These skulls are from creatures with short snouts and crowded teeth.
The researchers say that these two skulls are evidence that the domestication of dogs by humans occurred many times in early human history at different geographical locations. That would mean modern dogs have multiple ancestors rather than a single common ancestor. Meanwhile, neither the Siberian nor the Belgian dog lineage survived the peak of the last ice age around 20,000 years ago, so neither skull represents an ancestor of your dog.
One of the researchers made an interesting comment about dogs. He said we typically think of domestication as being cows, sheep, and goats, animals that provide food or other products. Dogs don't provide these products. They provide protection, companionship, and help on the hunt. So it's interesting, he said, that dog domestication appears to have happened first out of all human relationships with animals. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do, they smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers, backstabbers. They smile in your face. All the time they want to take your place. The backstabbers.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. According to a statement just released by the House Speaker of the House, John Boehner, and Majority Leader Eric Cantor, and Majority Whip Kevin McCarthy, House Republicans will be offering an extension of the payroll tax cut through the end of 2012 without spending offsets. Now, that's not saying that they're not going to attach something else to it, like the pipeline or, you know, who knows what else on the unemployment. But this is a blank. This is the Republicans going, uh-oh, we've gotten ourselves into some deep water, because you know what? Everybody wants that tax cut to go through. And we're going to be seen as the people who've said no. So this is one that they're going to have to swallow. Also, I don't know if you saw the story last week. We talked about it. The Congressional Budget Office pointed out that U.S. corporate tax revenues have hit a 40-year low. And you go, well, gee, why is that? Well, big reason is because they're shifting money to the Cayman Islands and to other places where they can hide it. In fact, the U.S. government said they've estimated the loss to be about somewhere between about $90 billion in revenue in 2008 from profit shifting. That's up from the $60 billion in 2004. They said, to put the figure in perspective, the corporate income tax only raised an average of $300 billion per year during the 2004-2008 time span. So in 2004, the corporate tax rate raised about $300 billion, $60 billion left. Think about that. That's a fifth. Think about that. And in 2008, $90 billion left. And the folks over at Think Progress pointed out that that's more money than we spend on the Department of Homeland Security. That's more money than we spend on the Department of Education. That's more money than we spend on the Department of Housing and Urban Development. More money than we spend on Veterans Affairs. So we so cherish that tax handout, that tax haven, that place for big business to hide their money until they can con us into letting them repatriate it at a much lower rate, much, much more than Veterans Affairs, evidently. It's pretty amazing to me. And yet what we're willing to do, and I go back to the article before, you know, every one of the people that they talked to in the article said, oh, well, you know, we'd be willing to take less. We'd be willing to, we just don't want to raise anybody's taxes. Because they're thinking in the mindset of my neighbors. Because my neighbors are struggling like I am. Everybody I know is struggling to get by. I don't want their taxes to go up. Everybody they know is having a tough time. And you're right. I don't want to raise taxes on people who are struggling. But I look at the Romneys. I look at the Buffetts. I look at the billionaire class. I look at these huge multinationals who've been sticking it to us like there's no tomorrow. And I go, somebody, please stand up and say, you in the little town in Minnesota, and you in the little town in Pennsylvania who's struggling to make ends meet, who's forced to sign up your kids for school lunch programs, and you qualify for the earned income tax credit. We're not taxing you. You don't have it. Somebody with some rational thought. Somebody. Because all we hear is this rabid anti-tax mentality without going, well, what kind of tax are we talking about? Can we tax things that wouldn't affect us? Is it possible? Of course it's possible. We just don't have the political will because the billionaire class pulls the strings of the people that are in office. It's pretty simple stuff. It doesn't get any easier than that. And I'm so frustrated when I hear people say, "Well, we just can't raise taxes because now it's gonna hurt the economy." Nonsense. You know, we were told during the Bush years, and we've been told this time and time again, that if we just cut taxes, it'll create jobs. And we cut taxes, it's going to help the economy. No, that's not always true. You give somebody a tax cut, small business owner, they're going to say thanks for the tax cut. I've got no customers, so I'm just going to take a quick break and leave. It's just mind blowing. Anyway, let's quick go to the phones. I got Robert on the line. How are you doing today, Robert?
I'm great, Rick. You're doing great work, man.
I appreciate it.
I want to talk to you about some of the programs that we got under the New Deal. And, you know, right now the Republicans are fueling on not necessarily always racial bigotry or racism, but they sure as heck are getting a lot of mileage out of racial anxiety. And with us having our first black president, which I think is a great thing, it really brings you back to look at how the New Deal was really excluded a lot of African American people, non-white people. Take a look at Levittown that was built across the United States. Those were excluded, just to give you an example. What we're seeing now, I think, in America is, even though we have political rights, there is such a lack of inclusion in our economic system, and programs that go to help us, like earned income tax credits, food stamps, whatever you have, what we're really doing now in reality is we're subsidizing business. We're subsidizing corporations.
But Robert, isn't that what we've always done? I mean, I can go back and say, you know, unemployment. I can go back and say food stamps. That had nothing to do with really raising people up. It had everything to do with saving businesses and saving jobs so that the economy gets going, because we've always had this thought of business friendly and business first.
Yeah, I'll agree with that 100%. And, you know, the conservative point of view is that, you know, it's just one big operation bootstrap. Everybody's going to have this mobility that we don't have anymore in this country, which is very disappointing. I'm very fearful for the future of my children. And yet, I've been to other countries in the world, Europe, where their economic systems are not completely at odds and having this adversarial relationship with capitalism and corporations. Everybody just seems to get along, whereas us, we're just completely divided all the time, and we're induced to be divided.
Yep. Well, I mean, that's the whole media structure. I mean, you know, I think of the guy who I talked about earlier. You know, the reality is he's inundated with the message that, you know, these things are bad and that, you know, good, honest, good free market, laissez-faire capitalism is the answer. So it's not surprising that that's the direction he's going to go.
You know, I heard part of that story, and I don't know if it resolved because it was – I was on hold, but did you end up talking to him? Did you ever end up trying to square his ideas with
Never going to happen. Never going to happen.
So you never even made an attempt?
No, we had conversations. Never going to happen. I mean, and now, unfortunately, he's now suffering from Alzheimer's because he was an older guy. But, you know, the reality is there are a lot of people like him and a lot of folks that I remember. Robert, I appreciate the call. I'd love to have you call back again.
Thanks
more time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Robert. Yeah, I mean, it's sad, and I feel for the guy, and you know, but it is what it is. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern. Sang a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Los Angeles Unified School District officials are considering plans to cut funding for all adult education. The move will have a detrimental impact on 300,000 students throughout the city who rely on the program for courses in the English language, basic education, and job training. Leilani Albano has more on the story.
When Elena Mikhailieva arrived in America almost 2 years ago, she didn't speak much English. But with the help of instructors at Evans Community Adult School in Los Angeles, she's made major strides in her language skills. Mikhailieva is among the 300,000 adult education students who are taking English language and basic education courses. Adult school programs also help struggling high school students earn credits towards graduation. And many students say it's helped to make positive changes in their lives. But that may come to an end due to a plan by the school district to scrap adult education. Mikhailieva says cutting adult education is a bad idea.
It's so important to know English and to have well-educated people in America.
Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent John Daisy announced plans last month to stop the $120 million of funding for the Division of Adult and Career Education. The annual allotment goes towards 30 adult education campuses. Adult school classes are also taught in thousands of K-12 campuses, churches, and other spaces throughout the city. The classes offer a wide range of courses that include culinary arts, auto repair, nursing, landscaping, electronics, graphic design, and computer programming. Opponents of the cuts held several demonstrations so far, including an action on February 8, where protests were held on 10 campuses. The cuts will have the biggest impact on poor and immigrant communities in Los Angeles, who have benefited the most from adult school programs. Shutting down classes may have an economic impact, too. Matthew Kogan, chair of the Adult Education Committee for the union United Teachers Los Angeles, says the cuts will only worsen the city's ongoing crisis.
Los Angeles already has a large undereducated population. I think it'll make an already divided city economically more divided.
Superintendent Daisy says the district has few options but to eliminate adult education as a way to fill the district's $540 million shortfall. He says it's either that or the district will be forced to cut preschools, elementary school arts, as well as thousands of administrators, teachers, nurses, cafeteria workers, and custodians.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside there's feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard of Republicans today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant cause they'll wonder if you're gay.
That'd be a good idea. Give him a good big old hug, big bear hug. Maybe squeeze some sense into him. Our quote of the day comes from Arlene Violet, a former Rhode Island Attorney General. She wrote a piece, Have We Become a Plutocracy? She says folks in this country have begun to ask, have to begin to ask themselves whether democracy is still working or, as she says, she believes that we have fallen into a plutocracy. Gridlock is just a game being perpetrated in Washington to maintain the status quo of wealth for the few. And I look at this story in the New York Times, and I don't know how you can make the argument to the contrary. And I think about my friend who, you know, I've had so many conversations with on this just amazing to me how you can be taking programs and be benefiting from them and bad-mouthing them at the same time. Pretty amazing. Anyway, I've asked Nicole Wu, Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, to come talk to us about the article and their response. Nicole, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, good afternoon, Rick.
You know, you hear the, a lot of my friends anyway, you know, who look around at their neighbors and look around at their friends and see that those people are struggling just like they are. And they've bought into this frame that, the country's broke. We just can't help each other anymore. We can't fund education. We can't do any of this stuff because we're just flat broke and it's government's fault.
Well, the first point is that we're not broke. We do have higher deficits now than we did a few years ago, but that's because of the recession. That's the way the safety net works. When people fall into hard times, government spending goes up, and I think most folks would support that, as you could see in the New York Times article. Even when they're receiving it, you know, they express gratefulness for it. And that's how it works. You know, we spend more money on food stamps and UI, unemployment benefits, which are important. And at the same time, revenue, the taxes drop greatly during a recession because less people are working and profits are down. And so the deficits are a temporary thing, you know, the really serious deficits. In terms of future deficits, almost all of it is due to health care. And if we don't start talking about health care rather than, you know, government programs, we're all going to be in trouble. Even if we were to get rid of all government programs, if our health care spending continues to skyrocket, and I'm talking about the private health care system, our economy is going to be in trouble in a few decades. The reason it looks so bad for our government spending is because Medicare pays almost half of the private health care tab.
Yeah, and bringing that up, you know, a good portion of what health care in this country is provided is through the government. They're the ones paying for it, which is why it's amusing to me that we have so many on the right who are screaming that Obamacare is taking over health care, which it's not. I mean, it's based on the for-profit model. I'm just kind of amused by it.
President Obama's health plan is, you know, pretty much identical to Governor Romney's health care plan, which is pretty much identical to the Republicans' health care plan back during the Clinton years, and which actually came from a Heritage Foundation blueprint. But because, you know, it passed under a Democratic president's auspices, there's an immediate reaction, I think. You know, some other points about health care. We spend twice as much per person as any other developed nation, almost twice as much as a portion of our economy. And meanwhile, our life expectancies are lower. Our infant mortality rates are way higher than other developed countries. So we're getting less bang for our buck for health care spending. And if there was a way to bring those costs down, that would be, you know, that would solve our deficit problem. If we could get our health care costs down to what other developed countries spend per person, we'd be looking at budget surpluses in the future.
But Nicole, we wouldn't have the best health care in the world.
I don't know where you can say it's the best health care in the world when we spend the most and we get the least results.
That's the reason, because we spend so much.
Yeah,
it's our prescription drug plan. We pay full price because we're Americans, damn it.
Yep, and, you know, under the Medicare Act back in the mid-2000s, it was specifically written into the law that the government cannot negotiate with the drug companies. That was written in, so we locked in our high prices.
And that makes us a great nation because we're prosperous and we can go and boast that we pay more than everybody. That's the only rationale I can come up with. I can't think of any other reason why you would say, you know, maybe it was the guy negotiating it. Maybe it was the guy who was behind the scenes twisting arms, that former Congressman Billy Townsend, who then left immediately to go be a high-priced lobbyist. Well, maybe that had something to do with it. But anyway, I'm sure that, you know, he thought, hey, we're Americans. We should pay full price. Or maybe not. But, you know, you look at this stuff, and it's amazing to me that they can, with a straight face, then turn around and say that, you know, we have the best health care in the world and that, you know, they care about health care at all. I'm just kind of shocked by it.
Yeah, I mean, reading the New York Times article, my heart certainly goes out for the folks that were profiled in the article. You know, they're struggling, they're trying so hard, and the hardest part, I think, is that they feel ashamed of taking government help. They feel
Absolutely.
Like they're failures, and that it's almost a blaming the victims sort of culture that we're building here. When we don't look at the larger system, which, you know, just shows that, you know, over the last 25 or 30 years, the vast majority of gains in our economy have gone to the top 1%, and that there are all these tax breaks and loopholes and other policies that are basically corporate welfare that keep sending workers' productivity up to the top. And, you know, so that's been cut out of the conversation for the most part, and people aren't hearing about what happens before they even get paid, you know, before they have to start relying on government programs. You know, the reasons that they're making so little per year to start with is because of these other government policies that are actually going towards the wealthiest.
Yeah, but if people actually thought that way, then they would be upset and they would join unions and they would organize and they would demand better wages, hours, conditions, better benefits. They would demand all those things, and that would really upset the Koch brothers and the billionaire class, because maybe we wouldn't have such a large, prosperous billionaire class.
Exactly.
Because here again, I'm proud of the fact that we've got, 1,300 billionaires? That's something of national pride, I guess.
It really depends on how you want to measure a society. Do you want to look at, you know, the top, or do you want to look at the bottom? And there are some philosophers and economists out there who say that you have to look at how a society treats the least of its society in order to actually judge how the society is doing, rather than focusing on how the wealthiest are doing. So yeah. It's the focus. I think there was somebody in the Bible who talked about that as well.
Oh, don't talk about the Bible here in Pennsylvania. This is the year of the Bible. Evidently, our legislature thought it was important enough to take time out of their day to vote on a resolution to make 2012 the year of the Bible. And then they go and they applaud a budget put out by our governor that cuts funding to the social programs. It just slashes education. Lots of pain, lots of cut and punish for working people. And hey, tax breaks for corporations.
Yeah, I don't remember Jesus talking about tax breaks for corporations, but I haven't read my Bible in a while.
That's because they edited that part out.
Oh.
That ended up, it's one of the Gnostics. It's one of those things that found that we don't believe in anymore.
Hmm.
Right there with, you know, the Judas, the book of Judas. So so now you know. But no, seriously, going back to this point that, you know, people do feel some shame in this. I remember as a kid, you know, growing up in a housing project, there were times my mother had to go on welfare because she couldn't find a job. And, you know, she had a small kid, and she's going, you know, hey, I got to feed this kid somehow. I need the help. And it killed her. And I don't wish that on anybody. But the reality is we have lost millions of jobs. The recession just decimated families. And the attack on workers for the past 30 years has really put a squeeze on the middle class in this country. And you tie that to our trade policy that has allowed jobs to go overseas. And not only allowed it, but we funded it. And you wonder why we're where we are.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you'll even see that, you know, people who have the best intentions, for example, in the president's budget today, there's a lot of focus on worker training and skills. And, you know, that's important in a regular economy to increase people's skills. But as you said, the jobs have been decimated, and there just aren't any jobs out there. And you see that when you look at the education levels of the unemployed. You know, every level of society has been hit by, you know, the jobs crisis. And so right now the problem is that there aren't any jobs out there. And it's not about, you know, getting your GED, for example, in order to get a job. There just aren't enough jobs out there. And, you know, it's unfortunate that we have no space in the political conversation to talk about doing some more government stimulus spending in order to pump up the demand and to create some more job openings. And, again, it feeds into this blaming the victim culture that, you know, people – you know, my heart goes out to them. They think that, oh, if I only had my education, I'd be able to get a job right now. In today's economy, there are no jobs.
Yeah, we've been sold this. If I just worked a little harder,
exactly.
You know, I would get ahead. And the reality is you know, you stay on the treadmill long enough, you're never getting off. And that's pretty much where we are.
Right.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Nicole Wu, Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You know, you brought up job creation there for a second, and I'm going, you know, we need to have big thinking. You know, we need to do, I think of the speech that Thomas Friedman gave, and I've used this example 1,000 times because I think it's so important. He said he had flown from Beijing to LAX, and in his mind, it was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. We used to be the nation around the world that everyone envied with our infrastructure. We can't even get a meager transportation bill passed, a meager infrastructure bill passed in this country, because the right is just so insane with this idea that somehow we can cut spending, somehow we can gut social programs, somehow we can freeze federal workers, and the economy will just grow by itself. Does that make any sense?
Well, you know, they've tried this again and again. You know, we tried trickle down during the Reagan years. You know, they've had their tries. They tried cutting taxes during the Bush years, and it hasn't panned out for them. Their theories have been proven wrong over and over again, and yet they continue to kind of double down on their bets. One interesting thing, though, about infrastructure, though, is that, you know, we had this debate about the Keystone Pipeline a few weeks ago, where they were yelling and screaming that it would, you know, the pipeline would create a few thousand jobs. So they were admitting that infrastructure spending does create jobs.
Yep.
But for some reason, it doesn't translate into any other kind of infrastructure, unless it's oil pipelines, apparently. But it would be great to sort of talk to some people on the other side and ask them, you know, okay, is this a place where we can have some agreement? And maybe we can agree that infrastructure spending does create jobs, and maybe we can move forward from there.
Yeah, but the problem is they go back to the point, well, I'd love to, Rick, or I'd love to, Nicole, but we're broke.
Well, they were willing to do it for Keystone, which is what I think is the really interesting, you know, little, you know, opening right there, was that, you know, they were, you know, pushing hard for this pipeline.
Yeah, but that would make us energy independent in their minds, even though no one's been able to tell me where that oil's going. I know where it's going. It's going to China, but no one's going to tell me that.
Right.
Just what it is. I guess we're going to remain down this path. Nicole, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick Santorum is the latest darling of the most extreme of the GOP's extremist voters. And wow, get an earful of this guy's moral piety. Let's start where it all starts for us humans, conception. Not only does Santorum insist that life begins at the instant that a sperm contacts an egg, he also wants to preserve the sanctity of the sperm itself by outlawing birth control. Yes, every sperm counts. Last October, he warned about, quote, the dangers of contraception in this country. It's not okay. It's a license to do things in a sexual realm that is counter to how things are supposed to be. Indeed, Ayatollah Rick is a bit obsessed with what you might be doing in your bedroom. The Supreme Court, he asserts, was wrong to rule that we have a right to consensual sex in our homes. Then you have the right to bigamy, he wails, the right to polygamy, to incest, adultery, the right to anything. Then comes his punchline, this right to privacy doesn't exist, in my opinion, in the United States Constitution. In a January interview on CNN, the sanctimonious Santorum offered another startling insight into his moral code. When asked what he would say to his daughter if she had been raped, was pregnant, and was crying for an abortion, he actually said, the right approach is to accept this horribly created, in the sense of rape, gift of life, and accept what God is giving you. He added that his daughter, and presumably yours too, ought, quote, to make the best out of a bad situation. This is Jim Hightower saying, so much Rick, so little time. I haven't even gotten to global warming, no such thing, he says. Or his endorsement of the Crusades as being about, quote, core American values. Or his comparison of homosexuality to man-on-dog sex. But with Santorum now in the spotlight, we can count on many more Rickisms to enlighten us.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast from the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. So a majority of Catholic voters now support President Obama's new contraception policy, according to the folks at the Coalition to Protect Women's Health Care. Just 29% of Catholics polled opposed the policy, while 59% of Catholic women supported it. Add to that 5% who wanted the policy to be much stronger. And I know in the Smith household, it was an issue that, came up, because my wife is like one of those, are you kidding me? She's not political whatsoever. Probably doesn't have a political bone in her body unless you're talking about breastfeeding. But, you know, this is one of those things, you know, just kind of the wake-up call. And you see, because I think women, I think this is going to be the moment when women who, like my wife, don't really care, don't really aren't really involved or connected, see it as, what, you want me to go back 100 years? I don't think so. And you look at Paul Ryan, who called the cave by the president, you know, just an accounting gimmick, you know, something that, you know, that women don't really want, and, you know, it's still going to force them to pay for things. It's just an accounting gimmick. It still enforces insurance companies to have to pay for coverage. And I'm sitting here thinking, I'm going, you know, where are the women on this issue? Where are the women in Congress? And immediately I thought of Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins, who in the past have both sponsored legislation that would do the exact same thing, would mandate that insurers offer contraception plans. In the past, they've done it. In the past, they've been in favor of it. Now the church went all crazy. They said, oh, we better rethink this. But they came out with a statement today, said it appears that the changes that have been made that prevent women's health services without compelling Catholic organizations in particular to violate the beliefs and tenets of their faith, so they're in favor of it. They say the administration has finally listened to the concerns raised by many, and it appears seeking to avoid the threat of religious liberties posed in the original plan. So they're now on board. They're okay. Kay Bailey Hutchinson, the Republican from Texas, who co-sponsored a bill in 1999, same thing, not yet in on the issue. But I find it amazing and hysterical that there are so many very old white men all enraged about this, and most of them not even Catholic, which is the other part of this that I find hysterical. But it is just what it is. And it's just part of this assault on women's rights. And there are, you know, I look at the Phyllis Schlafly's of the world, and I can't wait to find out where she falls down on this. But, you know, basically the useful idiots, the ones out there, well, we're against the feminist movement because, you know, those feminists want us to get equal pay, and they want us to have equal rights. And, well, we don't want that. We like being subservient. And, okay, I guess she was pretty well paid for. But I look at this Liz Trotta. She's a Fox News contributor. She was on one of Fox's shows, talking about this. Evidently, the Pentagon had announced some new rules, easing the ban on women in combat. And, you know, Rick Santorum, you know, kind of his head exploded, and some other people, their heads exploded. But this woman's responses were really kind of, well, bizarre. Let me just play her what she said.
Just a few weeks ago,
or maybe I won't. Let me just play what she said.
Just a few weeks ago, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta commented on a new Pentagon report on sexual abuse in the military. I think they've actually discovered there's a difference between men and women. And the sexual abuse report says that there's been, since 2006, a 64% increase in violent sexual assaults. Now, what did they expect? These people are in close contact. The whole airing of this issue has never been done by Congress. It's strictly been a question of pressure from the feminists.
Yeah, those evil feminists. It's the feminists' fault that they're getting raped. 64% in violent sexual assaults since 2006. 64% increase. And her response is, well, what did they expect? They were asking for it. Evidently, that's her view. She says these people are in close contact. So obviously, they're in close contact, so you can't violently assault someone? I mean, is that what you're getting from her? It's pretty amazing. Continues. This gets, well, listen.
Let me just read something to you from McClatchy newspapers about how much this position on extreme feminism is costing us. The budget for the Defense Department's Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office leapt from $5 million in fiscal 2005 to more than $23 million in fiscal 2010. Total Defense Department spending on sexual assault prevention and related efforts now exceeds $113 million annually. That's from McClatchy newspaper. So you have this whole bureaucracy upon bureaucracy being built up with all kinds of levels of people to support women in the military who are now being raped too much.
And that makes me think, is there an acceptable level of rape? Is there a happy median? Is a little rape okay? Because according to her, this is just a, this is kind of like frivolous to her. I mean, it's really just kind of mind-blowing. So the guy steps in, this the host, this Eric Sean, he goes, well, you know, you do want to kind of protect people, no? I mean, a little bit?
Well, you certainly want the people fighting the war to be protected from anything that could be illegal.
Oh, look, I mean, that's a nice try, Eric. This whole question of women in the military has not been aired properly, and it's the great sleeping giant.
It's a radical feminist. It's those women who want to, they want to serve their country, and they, it's kind of amazing to me. And this idea that, you know, somehow there's this acceptable amount of rape, there's this acceptable limit. Not the outrage, not as ticked off as I would be. There's none of that from her. And I can't really come to a rational position why. Is it that these folks are incapable of controlling themselves? I'm not quite sure. Now, personally, this is where I'll probably get into trouble. Truth of the matter is, yeah, you do. You have to expect this because you're teaching people to dehumanize folks. War is hell. The whole thing with the guys taking a leak on the dead Taliban guys. There was an outrage. And I said when I saw it, I said, look, what do you expect? You've now treated these people as second-class citizens, as second, not even human. What do you expect's going to happen? And kind of the same thing with women. It's one of those things. But it's all part of this war, this assault on women's rights. And she's upset that we spent $113 million protecting them. Kind of insane. It's mind-blowing is what it is. And I'm hoping this election cycle wakes people up. I'm hoping we go to the polls with clearer vision, with eyes wide open. Because I think the discussion of the last couple of weeks especially has highlighted that there are some very, very major differences in the party platforms, in the party ideas. Now, are there some Democrats who are horrible on the issue and some Republicans who are probably good on the issue? A few. I mean, there's some crossover. But not as much as there had been in the, there's been in the past. I mean, there's much more of a homogenous line of thinking in the past, I think. There were some things that we agreed more on. And I think as the moneyed interests have intervened and really, really taken hold, not that they didn't in the past, but really more so lately. Because of Citizens United, because of all of the television advertisement and all of the pounding into people's ears. And I go back to my friend, and I do call him a friend. I don't hold any ill against him for his beliefs. It's all he knows. And that's part of the problem in this country. It's all we know. When the Koch brothers can spend $2 million at a place like Florida State University and have a veto on whoever they hire in the economics department, that's a huge problem because what? Every kid that comes out of that school now has this free market style of thinking that there is no alternative to laissez-faire capitalism. And that's just wrong. That open borders, free trade for goods, services, and money, that's wonderful, but people not so much. And it puts us into the situation we're in. And that's what bothers me about this whole move towards privatizing education, K-12 education, which is where we're going. We're heading down that path to profitizing, privatizing every function of our government. And I don't know. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Carla Walter, senior policy analyst at the American Worker Project over at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Stick around. Right back after this.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Evidence announced in early 2012 suggests that today's dogs might have originated from more than one ancient ancestor.
Scientists found a 33,000-year-old dog-like skull in a cave in Siberia. They compared it to equally ancient dog-like remains from a cave in Belgium. The researchers from the University of Arizona said both the Siberian and the Belgian skulls came from domesticated dogs rather than wolves. Wolves have long, thin snouts, and their teeth aren't crowded. These skulls are from creatures with short snouts and crowded teeth.
The researchers say that these two skulls are evidence that the domestication of dogs by humans occurred many times in early human history at different geographical locations. That would mean modern dogs have multiple ancestors rather than a single common ancestor. Meanwhile, neither the Siberian nor the Belgian dog lineage survived the peak of the last ice age around 20,000 years ago, so neither skull represents an ancestor of your dog.
One of the researchers made an interesting comment about dogs. He said we typically think of domestication as being cows, sheep, and goats, animals that provide food or other products. Dogs don't provide these products. They provide protection, companionship, and help on the hunt. So it's interesting, he said, that dog domestication appears to have happened first out of all human relationships with animals. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Yeah, it's not a moral objection. This is about the free exercise of religion. And under our Constitution, you don't take a poll to find out how people feel about a constitutional freedom. In fact, the Bill of Rights are designed to protect minority views. So what the overall view on the issue of contraception is has nothing to do with an issue about religious freedom. And in this country, the government doesn't get to tell you or your organization what your religious views are, and they could well be minority views. But the Bill of Rights is designed to protect the minority from the will of the majority.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. So as you heard, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, this weekend he was on To Face the Nation. And he said also that he supported a bill giving employers the right to exclude any type of health service that they find objectionable. And oddly enough, he went on into the Constitution, as you heard, guaranteeing minority rights, in which is kind of interesting. But from a worker's perspective, if my employer can decide what health coverage I get, which services I'm allowed, what happens between me and my doctor, what other powers am I going to be giving up? And I think it's an excellent opportunity for working people in this country to take a long look at employment rights, what few we have, and go from there. And here to talk about the issue is Carla Walter. She's a senior policy analyst over at the Center for American Progress Action Fund's American Worker Project. Carla, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I listened to his view on this, and I can only wonder what else can my employer then do if he can dictate what I get for health care.
Yeah, and I think that it's so wrong-headed to be invoking the Constitution here. You know, we all enjoy religious freedoms. Employers, like the rest of us, enjoy the freedom to practice whatever religion they would like to. But the Constitution doesn't say that some employers are subject to rules in place, are able to flaunt the rules that are in place for other employers. You know, our religious freedoms are about what religions we practice, not rules for employment.
You know, and isn't that the argument to take this and have it thrown out? Because now you've decided that, well, they're excluded and I'm not going to be. And just because I don't believe what they believe, somehow I'm included and they're not. I mean, isn't that the natural argument?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, employers have to obey lots of laws. They have to employ labor law. They have to employ tax law. They have to obey workers' compensation. And, you know, it's a very slippery slope here. And Mitch McConnell has signaled that he's willing to take it down this slippery slope, where he's saying that, you know, not only would he include religious employers like Catholic Charities in these exclusions, but also non-religious employers. So all of a sudden you've got a non-religious employer saying, well, I don't think I have to obey worker safety laws. You know, what's next?
Yeah, and this is where the next step becomes. Well, I don't have to obey minimum wage laws, and I don't have to have safe workplaces. I don't have to do any of that stuff, pretty much taking us back 100 years to the Lochner era.
Yeah, and, you know, and this is a political fight here. We've seen that over half of states have passed laws, employment laws, requiring insurers to cover contraception. And even the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission under President Bush in 2000 said that companies must provide prescriptions to their employees must provide birth control to their employees if they provide other prescription coverage, or otherwise they'd be in violation of the Civil Rights Act. And that was decided without any sort of controversy. The only difference here is that now the mandate is that they must do this at no cost to their employees. But, you know, this is something that's been decided, and now you see the right trying to rehash this. This is the same as trying to rehash public sector bargaining rights in Wisconsin and trying to rehash right-to-work laws in Indiana. This is a political fight that's being brought up again because the right sees this opportunity to start to tear away some of the rights that workers have long enjoyed or should enjoy.
You know, for me, and I look at this as an opportunity to say maybe it's time to move away from employer-based healthcare. I mean, maybe now we start looking at, because in my mind, the healthcare that my employer pays me, that's wages. Those are wages that I give up to have that that benefit. Or am I wrong here?
I could probably see either side of that. But what I do think is we have this real opportunity here. That Affordable Health Care Act passed, and it has some real, will make a real difference for a lot of people. This is one of those areas where it'll make a difference. And what we're seeing is conservatives don't want people to see what a difference this will make. They don't want people to start to say, oh, Obamacare, oh, that's a good thing. That's made a difference in my life, and now I feel this meaningful benefit. So I think
Yeah, I mean, but at the end of the day, I mean, we're stuck in a system where it's a pay-or-die system. Either you have health care, you have a job, you have health care, or you don't. Or you don't have a job and you don't get health care. And if you don't get health care, you die. That's where we are today. Now, in 2014, we'll be able to buy into things and do other stuff. But for the right now, the here and now, this is the world we live in.
That is correct.
You know, so my thought is look, at the end of the day, the health care that I'm getting, those are wages that you probably would have paid me if you weren't giving me health care. And there's part of me that says I like the building trade model where you say, here's X amount of dollars an hour, and you go buy your health care from the union or from an association or somewhere else.
Well, and if you have that opportunity to go buy from a union, that's great. But there's so many of the non-unionized sector out there that don't have that opportunity. So it's so important that when employers do provide health care, they provide health care benefits that people really use. And we know from survey after survey that women use contraception and that it's an important benefit to every religious denomination, including Catholic women. So, you know, this is a fight that has been waged in the political arena and in the religious arena, And I feel like Americans have spoken, and this is just so out of sync with what we, what workers need and what workers want.
Yeah, I agree. And while we're talking about religion and politics, two of the taboo topics, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, what's really frightening to me is you've got a handful of these bishops and these angry white guys who are out there pushing for policies to mandate that the women who are part of their congregation, the Catholic Church, that they use government to enforce their views on them. I'm
because
really
it hasn't been working in the church so far. Sorry.
What's that?
Speaking of, I said because it hasn't been working in the church so far.
Exactly.
That. Yeah. No, I mean, it's, listen, I grew up as a, you know, staunchly pro-union and of Irish Catholic heritage. And one of the things that was so important about the Catholic Church was its social justice backing and the strength of the Catholic Church in speaking to social justice issues. They still do a great job of that, and I just wish there was more of a focus on that.
Yeah, because I grew up in the same. Yeah, I grew up being beaten by nuns constantly, going to Catholic school, and it was really about peace and social justice.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this radical change that I see in the Catholic Church to where it's now mostly about abortion now, and that's the single-minded focus of most of my Catholic friends. And you say, while having grown up Catholic, I'm not in favor of it. I don't think we should criminalize it. I'm very pro-safety. But at the end of the day, why not make an environment where people want to bring children in this world instead of one where you're mandating that they do?
Yeah, and I think it's important to say that, you know, this isn't just a health care issue. This is a benefits issue. This is when I sign up for my great job and I hear it has health benefits, I am assuming that there's a certain package there. And as a worker, that's one of the things that I value when I'm evaluating an employer. And then to hear, oh, that's being pulled away from me, that's, you know, I think that this is one more thing that, you know, is being chipped away from workers as the values that, and the benefits they're getting.
Yeah, I had a friend this weekend ask me, well, you know, why do you care? You're not using it. I go, yeah, but I've got two daughters at some point that they may. And beyond this, the idea that my employer would have any say in my health care scares me to death. Because, you know, I grew up Catholic. They're against stem cell research for the most part. What if I need some type of stem cell treatment? Will they not cover that?
Well, yeah. I mean, where is the line? And where is the line, like I was saying earlier, Senator McConnell said over the weekend he'd be interested in extending this not just to religious organizations but to non-religious organizations who say that they have some sort of objection. Well, what if they start objecting to expensive cancer treatments or, you know, like you're saying, things funded through that are cutting edge research? Where is it when this is a debate that is, you know, yes, it's about religion, but it's also about the employment situation and when is the government going to step in and say, no, this is what fair employment is about?
Now, do you really think it's a religious argument? Because I don't. Because there's no mandate that you have to take it. I could see if, you know, we were having the argument that they were doing back in the 90s where the right wanted to make welfare mothers take Norplant. That's an argument. You're forcing them to do it. I'm just not getting the religious imperative here. I'm just not getting it because nobody's ramming it down your throat.
No, you're right. You're right. It is one of those things where it's a very personal decision, and it's the sort of thing where it's the government letting private employers have a say in this is it seems to cross a line.
It absolutely does, and it puts workers more on the defense and more at the mercy of their employers, which, you know, I don't think is a good idea at all, which is why I said I think we need to get away from employer-based health care entirely, in my opinion, but I'm sure I don't know if you agree or don't, but I just think you need to.
Well, I think that in the world we live in, we need to make sure that when employers provide health care, they provide the health care benefits that workers need and want.
Last question I've got for you. We were kicking around the idea of starting a church of collective bargaining. so that, you know, because, you know, we want to, since minorities have we have minority rights under McConnell's twisted ideas, then we can't take jobs or we can't do anything unless there's a collective bargaining agreement.
Well, I would attend.
All right. There you go. Carla Walter, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Senior policy analyst over at the American Worker Project for the Center for American Progress Action Fund, AmericanProgress.org, the website. We got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
There it is again, the auction song. I think my producer has some fixation on the auction song. Seems to enjoy that quite a bit. And, you know, you look at what we're doing across the state and kind of auctioning everything off. I had a conversation with a neighbor saying one of the things that scared her the most about her representative is this fixation on privatizing, on dumping all the public assets. I'm very happy to say, you know, going after education, going after the wine and spirit shops, going after, you know, everything. Not a matter of if we should, but what, how much. Just amazing stuff. Got an email during the break from Randall. He writes, "Vastly increased worker productivity is benefiting large corporations, but the beneficiaries are paying very little into the U.S. Treasury in taxes." He writes, "Some Fox News commentators were claiming that taxing rich people may not significantly decrease the U.S. annual budget deficits." But he says, "I think taxing rich people and rich corporations would. And I think taxing either one of them would help, so it's a step in the right direction. And it would also give us money to infuse into our economy to make sure that, oh, I don't know, we have opportunity, we have some activity." Just a quick thought. But thanks for the email, Randall. And again, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally and occasionally use them here on the program. So I don't know if you saw the big news. China's coming to dinner. They're saying it's kind of a, you know, kind of get to know you kind of thing. The president of the Communist Party now, you know, guy, his name's Xi Jinping, Jinping, is his name. He's going to be the new head guy there, in the fall. So he's coming to the U.S. to have a, you know, a, you know, kind of a sit down talk and do all those things, talk about, you know, what's going on. There's part of me that thinks it's more than, just let's get to know each other. It's let me see what I'm going to buy next is kind of what I'm thinking. I mean, you look at the massive budget deficits or trade deficits we have with them and the amount of money that we're borrowing, not only in, hey, we need money to borrow, but our trade deficit, the fact that we're sending them more money than their buying of our products. See, we buy their cheap goods. This is all part of that deficit. It's all part of the reserves that they hold. And you very seldom ever hear righties talking about it. Every time we buy something from them, we're sending them, theoretically, we're sending them money. So they send us this cheap widget, we send them money. We buy clothing, we send them money. We buy pants, we send them money. We buy knickknacks, paddywhacks, whatever, we're sending them money. Now, they're not buying stuff from us. Because generally how trade works is it's kind of a mutual thing. We buy stuff from you, you buy stuff from us, and it kind of all comes out in the wash. Well, we're not selling them. They're not buying from us. So, you know, they've got all these reserves, and they're looking around, and I say they're looking at what they're going to buy next. Because they don't buy things from us, they buy us. They're buying our companies, they're buying opportunities that we would have. They're buying our energy. You know that's coming. But while they sit down and talk, you know there's some things that they're gonna focus on. Iran is gonna be a big one. So expect as happens, Iran and North Korea are both acting up. You know it. So what are we gonna give the Chinese for them to put Iran and North Korea back in their place? Because they're the only ones who really can. Are we gonna give up on the currency manipulation, say, okay, well, we'll turn a blind eye to you manipulating your currency? Or are we going to turn a blind eye to their theft of intellectual property? Are we going to do that? I don't know. What are the Chinese going to say to Obama's plan to take another look at the Pacific concerning our defense strategy? Something you don't hear the righties talking about because it's a smart move. They don't want to give them any credit. Are they going to talk about China's human rights policy? Are they going to talk about the one-child rule, which the righties are just going nuts about? And the question I guess I have for my righty friends, what do you do about overcrowding? You know, as I've said, you know, a number of times, what they would do is they would not give them birth control because they need cheap labor. And I'm sure Obama's going to get beat up over what the Republicans are saying, what the presidential candidates are saying. You got Romney who just said the other day that he'd cut off all United Nations Population Fund money. Nothing to China because they have that barbaric one-child policy. And there's part of me that goes, you know, look, what do you do? You're already overcrowded. You've already got millions and millions of people who are starving. What do you do? Do you just let them starve to death? And I guess, you know, the reality is the righties probably would, you know, under the auspices of, well, God's will. And I guess energy will be a huge, huge problem because they get it. They're investing billions of dollars in alternative energy as we speak. Not to mention they're gobbling up our resources. And you, if you remember me last week talking about Santorum, he was talking to some crowd, I forget, in Colorado, saying that, you know, the mortgage crisis didn't cause the great collapse. The 2008 recession wasn't caused by, you know, by the housing bubble. No, it was the spike in energy prices. And you go, really? Are you that deluded? His rationale was people had to put gas in their cars and air condition their homes, so they didn't have money to pay their mortgage. That's where his mindset is, that you're going to not pay your rent, you're not going to pay your mortgage because you need air conditioning. That's what he thinks. But, you know, I stop and I think about this Keystone XL thing. I would be all in favor of it if you said, okay, well, we're going to bring that pipeline right into Chicago or here into Philadelphia. We're going to disperse that energy across the country. It's going to stay here. It's going to be domestic. We're not doing that. They're taking it down to Texas. It's going to be part of the international supply. And at $100 a barrel, you know why they want to build that pipeline. And they're going to do everything they can do to make sure that they keep hacking us for $3.50, $3.60, someday, real soon, $4 a gallon. And I look at today in Olympia, Washington, they're having a debate these environmental groups are having a debate on whether it's a good idea to have trains move like 10 full train loads of coal per day. I think it's like 1,250 loaded rail cars full of coal every single day, day after day after day after day after day, that goes right through Washington, right through South Sound, and is exported right to China. So, you know, I keep hearing people say, wow, you know, we need to be energy independent. We need to, you know, we need to drill, baby, drill. But every time we do, where does it end up? It ends up in the international market. 1,250 loaded rail cars every single day, 365 days a year, we're shipping overseas. Yet here in this country, prices are through the roof. We're paying $100 for oil. We could be transforming. And, you know, I see this story in the Wall Street Journal today, talking about natural gas production. The people have stopped drilling. Evidently, the prices have fallen so low that they're walking away from it. Back in 2008, it was about $8 per cubic unit or whatever what their unit is. 2 years ago, it was $5.50. Now it's $2.50 per cubic unit. So according to the people who are the drillers, they're saying, well, we're going to have fewer wells in 2012 because we're not getting the money out of it. And my mind is like, the argument here is, hey, can we ship this stuff overseas? You know, I know there were a couple of congressmen here in Pennsylvania, Glenn Thompson being one of them, the Republican from out west, saying we want to take that Marcellus Shale natural gas and we want to ship that to China. Because it's all about the business. It's not really about making this country energy independent. We don't really care about that. Understand, the U.S. last year was a net exporter of energy, of gasoline and diesel products. And yet our gas prices are still through the roof. Why? Because they've got us accustomed to pay it. They've got us right where they want us. And they keep talking about nonsense. Oh, we need to make more energy. We do? We are digging up 1,250 rail cars every single day that we're shipping to China. 1,250 just through Washington. Who knows what else we're getting rid of? Don't you think maybe if we really believed in energy independence, we would consider something else? And this thing with the natural gas, if we were going to be energy independent, wouldn't we mandate that stuff stay local? And if it were falling, wouldn't we say, you know what, we believe in being energy independent. We don't want foreign sources of energy, that we would help stabilize the industry? Evidently not. Evidently, we don't believe in that. And you look at this transportation bill that the Republicans have thrown out there, the $260 billion transportation bill. I don't know that you could have packed any more nitwitted things in there. Basically, the old 50s mentality of drill, baby, drill, and we're just going to pave roads. We're not going to actually upgrade anything. There's really not much in it. They cut funding for Amtrak. They cut funding for high-speed rail. Any progress done? Any bike paths or walking paths or anything other than cars gutted? And that's their transportation bill. That's the direction they want to lead this country. And they keep throwing out there, well, we need to be energy independent. You know what would help us be energy independent? Having better public transportation. That's a smart way to go. You have less congestion, you have less pollution, you have less people sitting on highways, you have a happier populace. But evidently, we don't have that kind of vision. We don't have that kind of foresight. And the reality being, other countries do. China is investing tens of billions of dollars, almost $100 billion the last time I saw, in alternative energy. India is expected to exceed their 2009 goal of producing 20,000 megawatts from solar by 2020. They're going to do that. We can't build a simple rail line. Evidently, we just can't. Sad, sad, sad stuff, folks. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with John Thrill Delkin. He is with the American Federation of Government Employees. He's their legislative representative. I'm going to talk about the down payment to protect the National Security Act of 2012, because we're going to fall back on and not hold up the bargain that the Republicans made and then reneged on. And then we're going to make the federal workers pay for it. And less service, less... It's the conservative way. Quick break, right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Los Angeles Unified School District officials are considering plans to cut funding for all adult education. The move will have a detrimental impact on 300,000 students throughout the city who rely on the program for courses in the English language, basic education, and job training. Leilani Albano has more on the story.
When Elena Mikhailieva arrived in America almost 2 years ago, she didn't speak much English. But with the help of instructors at Evans Community Adult School in Los Angeles, she's made major strides in her language skills. Mikhailieva is among the 300,000 adult education students who are taking English language and basic education courses. Adult school programs also help struggling high school students earn credits towards graduation. And many students say it's helped to make positive changes in their lives. But that may come to an end due to a plan by the school district to scrap adult education. Mikhailieva says cutting adult education is a bad idea.
It's so important to know English and to have well-educated people in America.
Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent John Daisy announced plans last month to stop the $120 million of funding for the Division of Adult and Career Education. The annual allotment goes towards 30 adult education campuses. Adult school classes are also taught in thousands of K-12 campuses, churches, and other spaces throughout the city. The classes offer a wide range of courses that include culinary arts, auto repair, nursing, landscaping, electronics, graphic design, and computer programming. Opponents of the cuts held several demonstrations so far, including an action on February 8, where protests were held on 10 campuses. The cuts will have the biggest impact on poor and immigrant communities in Los Angeles, who have benefited the most from adult school programs. Shutting down classes may have an economic impact, too. Matthew Kogan, chair of the Adult Education Committee for the union United Teachers Los Angeles, says the cuts will only worsen the city's ongoing crisis.
Los Angeles already has a large undereducated population. I think it'll make an already divided city economically more divided.
Superintendent Daisy says the district has few options but to eliminate adult education as a way to fill the district's $540 million shortfall. He says it's either that or the district will be forced to cut preschools, elementary school arts, as well as thousands of administrators, teachers, nurses, cafeteria workers, and custodians.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Scott Right Wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I work for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, make the rules, the bosses knew would leave. We had layoffs again this morning. I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me. When did I become a problem?
Hi, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You'll remember back on February 2nd, there were a group of Republican senators who proposed the down payment to protect National Security Act of 2012. You got to love the names they come up with. It was to stop the mandatory defense spending cuts that were triggered by their failure, the failure of the super-duper, super-secret, super-committee to come up with the reductions that they were supposed to find. And not surprisingly, the agreement that they made back then, they want to go back on. And also not surprisingly is they want working people to pay for it. They want their failure, again, on the backs of people who, well, people who work for a living. They plan on paying for it by reducing the number of federal workers and freezing their pay again, which is why we've asked John Threlkeld, the legislative representative from the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE.org, the website, to come talk to us. John, thanks for taking time for me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I look at this, and again, another example of you guys just being the whipping boys.
I think you're absolutely right. I love the way you phrased the discussion. You know, they're the ones, the Republican sponsors of the Down Payment on National Security Act bills. There's one in the House, one in the Senate, and they're slightly different from one another. But the Budget Control Act, which imposed sequestration if the supercommittee was unable to come to an agreement, you know, that was legislation they championed. You know, we warned lawmakers on both the left and the right that, you know, sequestration would have terrible, calamitous effects for DOD and all the other agencies because of the hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts that would be required. Nevertheless, Republicans in particular supported this legislation, and they never thought that sequestration would occur. And now that it has occurred, because, let's be honest, Republicans were unwilling to raise taxes on the top 1%, now that sequestration has occurred, they want to shield their favorite agency from the impact of sequestration. Just as a bit of background, the Obama administration will reduce defense spending over the next 10 years by about $487 billion. And as a result of sequestration, that's probably another $500 billion on top of that. And so Republicans are concerned about the impact of these cuts on DOD. We are concerned as well. We have urged the Congress to go back and revisit sequestration, to raise taxes on the top 1%, and to adjust the spending cuts so that they're not so precipitous and so threatening to our embryonic economic recovery. But you're absolutely right. We're the all-purpose whipping boy. You know, they're trying to use our compensation to pay for a reduction in the payroll tax. They're trying to use our compensation now to pay for a funding hole they have in their highway reauthorization bill that's going to be on the floor later this week in the House. And as you pointed out, they're trying to use us to, as the bill payer, to shield DOD from the impact of sequestration. And just a, you know, slight difference between the two bills. The House bill would reduce the federal workforce by an arbitrary 10% in order to offset the sequestration on DOD. And then the Senate bill would reduce the workforce by 5% and then freeze our pay for a third consecutive year. And the difference between the House and Senate bills in particular is that the Senate bill would shield all the agencies from sequestration initially. This is just initially,
right,
for the first couple of years. And they wanted to include more agencies than DOD because they were hoping to draw some Democrats into the fold. But so far, no Democrats are interested in co-sponsoring. It's gotten a rude reception from them, and it's also been rejected by the White House as well.
Well, at the end of the day, and there's this idea that we can cut and punish, this idea that we can continually cut government spending, and somehow we're going to grow the economy, that somehow by taking money out of your pocket and reducing the number of federal employees, that's going to be good for the economy. And I'm sorry, I'm just not seeing it.
I think you're absolutely right. There is a contempt that so many Republican lawmakers have for federal employees. They don't really regard them as real jobs. You know, to the extent that we have jobs that are worth performing, you know, they want to see these jobs contracted out to, you know, firms that reward them with campaign contributions.
Is it that simple, or is it just a visceral hatred and disdain for anything that is government? Because my view on it is we've got these people who've been put in by the billionaire class, really on both sides, but more so on the right side of the aisle, that just have a disdain for anything that is owned or done by we the people for ourselves through our government.
I think you're right. I think also the fact that we're close at hand helps. You know, we are the workforce that works directly for the House Republican Caucus, and so we're easy for them to go after. And you know, they're going after our collective bargaining rights. They want to go after our jobs, either eliminate the jobs arbitrarily or contract them out. Go after our pay. Go after our health care, retirement. There are truly draconian cuts being proposed with respect to our federal retirement program. And they like to play a beggar thy neighbor, you know, because other people have it badly. We're going to make federal employees suffer as well. Just with respect to the federal workforce cuts that they're proposing, you know, the federal workforce is very moderately sized compared to the country and the challenges that it faces. And there has been modest increases in the federal workforce during the Obama administration, but almost all of that has come in four agencies: DOD, Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, Department of Veterans Affairs. And, you know, you go up to these House Republicans who are determined to hack and whack at the federal workforce by arbitrary amounts, and you say, well, what veterans do you want to see turned aside? How do you want our national security compromised? How do you want our homeland security compromised? How do you want our borders not to be protected? And they don't have ideas. It's just like you say, it's a visceral dislike for federal employees, the public sector, and particularly federal employees who are unionized. And it didn't used to be this way. You know, I can recall as a lobbyist, because I've been working on at AFG for about 17 years, we used to work regularly with Republicans, particularly on DOD issues. And unfortunately, the party has gone so far to the right that they have very little time, very little interest, very little sympathy for the working middle-class Americans who make up the federal workforce.
You know, let me ask you this, because, you know, you bring up an interesting point that, it's easy to go after you, but, you know, where do you cut? And I think most Americans have bought into this line because they've heard it ad nauseum. It's been repeated and regurgitated constantly by the megaphones of the mega-rich on the right. I think most people don't know what federal employees do, so it's easy to say, well, we should get rid of them because I don't know what they do and nobody's told me what they do. But we all believe, you know, hey, we should secure our borders, we should have strong defense, we should take care of the people we call heroes, all of those things. And all I see is, you know, cut, cut, and punish, going after the people that and the jobs that we say we want done. It's kind of silly.
Well, I spend most of my time working on privatization issues. A very small percentage of the contractor workforce is unionized, and that's what appeals to a lot of Republican lawmakers who are adamant about privatizing work performed by federal employees.
Since you brought that up, let me ask you. I don't mean to cut you off, but you know, because I just had a conversation with a friend of mine who's part of the Pennsylvania League of Women's Voters, and this year their big issue is privatization. And I said, well, you're about 30 years too late on that one because that train has left the building. Are there any examples where you're going to say privatization saved us, you know, millions of dollars, was the best thing for us? Because everything that I see that we've privatized costs me more, and I get less for.
Well, I don't think that there's any question that most people don't appreciate the extent to which the federal government is over-reliant on contractors. And not too long ago, you may have talked about this study on your program, but the Project on Government Oversight did a seminal study comparing federal employees to contractors in terms of cost to the taxpayers. And they, out of 37 occupational categories, determined that federal employees were cheaper in 35 of those categories. And that usually we were one to two times cheaper than contractors. And I should say that the Project on Government Oversight accepts no union contributions, and in fact we often disagree with the Project on Government Oversight on sourcing and procurement matters. But you know, it's a study that, you know, congressional Republicans aren't interested in because they have a mindset that federal employees are worthless and that their jobs are not worthy and that they should be contracted out because invariably the public sector is inferior to the private sector. And I work a lot on DOD issues, and there's no question that we need to reduce defense spending, but there's no question that we cannot reduce defense spending without looking very closely at how much we spend on contractors. We spend between two and three times the amount of money that we spend on federal employees. We spend two and three times that on contractors. I think the civilian personnel cost the federal government about $70 billion in FY10. and contractors cost about $181 billion.
Wow.
In FY10.
You know, and I look at this, and you know, you go back to, you know, in looking at the wars that we just fought, you had privatized supply lines. I don't know that I'm all that thrilled. If I were a soldier over there, I'd be thrilled with having private for-profit corporations providing my supplies.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and the military isn't comfortable either, because they're interested in quality control and having authority over all the forces arrayed in theater. And in fact, there is quite a bit of concern about the extent to which the Defense Department and indeed the Homeland Security Department is reliant on contractors for functions that most people think should be performed by federal employees. You know, things like overseeing other contractors, developing regulations, preparing congressional testimony. And so there is an effort underway, and it's actually bipartisan. I got to give congressional Republicans credit for this. It's a bipartisan effort to force the Department of Defense to stop using contractors for inherently governmental functions and to incrementally bring back in-house functions which are probably too important or sensitive to privatize. But obviously it's fiercely resisted by contractors.
In fact,
and this is a little-known fact, DOD in the last 2 years has added about 30,000 jobs to the civilian workforce through insourcing. You know, we hear a lot about outsourcing, but we've been able to get insourcing done in certain instances, and about 50% of those 30,000 jobs will have been insourced for cost reasons. That is to say, the Department of Defense thought we were more efficient, and another 50% for performance reasons. They were just uncomfortable having contractors perform work that was too important or too sensitive.
Yeah, and you can't hold them accountable. And one of the things that I saw recently, and I don't know if you want to comment on it, but maybe I'm wrong on it. But the FAA reauthorization bill in there, does it talk about privatizing the TSA in different airports?
It certainly makes it more difficult for TSA to justify keeping work in-house. You know, I thought everybody learned after 9/11 that, you know, this is a function too important to outsource. But unfortunately, you know, there are some congressional Republicans out there who are fearful because, you know, these 45,000 screeners have chosen to be represented by my union, the American Federation of Government Employees. And I think anti-union animus plays a big part of that, and so they're interested in pushing TSA to privatize. Now, to the agency's credit, they don't seem that interested in privatizing federal employees, but there's no question that the FAA bill that was passed recently by the Congress, that makes it more difficult for TSA to justify keeping this inherently governmental work in the hands of reliable and experienced federal employees.
Yeah, you see, I thought during the 70s we learned the lesson about having hardened doors in the cockpit, but evidently we didn't learn that lesson either. I guess, Churchill was right. Americans always do the right thing after doing everything else first. I look at this privatization scheme, and I think a lot of people are upset about the scanning practices and all of the things that go along with it. So I guess my question is once we privatize this, and my position is that once we privatize it, we have no complaint because it's a private for-profit entity that's doing it. I'm curious what your thought is. Once we privatize this and the rules come down on how it has to go, do people have any more rights?
Well, I think TSA is very uncomfortable supervising privatized workforces because they don't think that they can get the same sort of uniformity and performance and quality control with contractors that they can with federal employees. But at the same time, they're fearful that the agency will get blamed if there are any mistakes or screw-ups by the contractor.
And they will.
So I think that's why, you know, the agency is so determined to keep the work in-house and have it be performed by reliable and experienced federal employees.
Well, John, I appreciate the information. I appreciate the input. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time, sir.
John Threlkeld, the legislative representative over at the American Federation of Government Employees, AFGE.org, the website. You know, and I look at this, and it's the same schemes. It's the privatization. It's the cut, cut, and punish. You know, it's the assault on workers in general. And the right has done a masterful job. They have done a fantastic job of pounding on these people. Can you imagine? You know, we're going to pass this, but we're going to do it on the backs of these people. And they've spent years demonizing these folks, and even the president, his budget another $27 million or $27 billion hit on federal workers. Because look, you know, they want them to contribute more to their health care. They want to pay freezes, and they want all of these things piled on top and piled on top. They're the like I said, they're the whipping boys. Instead of doing what we know needs to be done, cutting the Bush tax cuts, ending the big handouts to big corporations, ending the idea that they're going to be allowed to hold money in offshore accounts, and begin taxing people rationally, reasonably. You know, at times when our tax rates are higher, the country's more prosperous. The country's in better shape. But, you know, we keep listening to the radical right down as, well, you know what we need lower taxes so that wealthy people can be wealthier and, well, you can do without. And I hear my Tea Party friends all the time, well, you're talking redistribution of wealth, Rick. It's redistribution of wealth. But they don't seem to get the fact that how the wealth has been redistributed away from us. And it's really just another attack on working people. You know, much like the McConnell thing. If employers don't want to offer something, they shouldn't have to. It's taken us backwards, folks. Taken us, you know, back, like I've said numerous times, to the good old days of the 90s, the 1890s. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Evidence announced in early 2012 suggests that today's dogs might have originated from more than one ancient ancestor.
Scientists found a 33,000-year-old dog-like skull in a cave in Siberia. They compared it to equally ancient dog-like remains from a cave in Belgium. The researchers from the University of Arizona said both the Siberian and the Belgian skulls came from domesticated dogs rather than wolves. Wolves have long, thin snouts, and their teeth aren't crowded. These skulls are from creatures with short snouts and crowded teeth.
The researchers say that these two skulls are evidence that the domestication of dogs by humans occurred many times in early human history at different geographical locations. That would mean modern dogs have multiple ancestors rather than a single common ancestor. Meanwhile, neither the Siberian nor the Belgian dog lineage survived the peak of the last ice age around 20,000 years ago, so neither skull represents an ancestor of your dog.
One of the researchers made an interesting comment about dogs. He said, we typically think of domestication as being cows, sheep, and goats, animals that provide food or other products. Dogs don't provide these products. They provide protection, companionship, and help on the hunt. So it's interesting, he said, that dog domestication appears to have happened first out of all human relationships with animals. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. Because God is a Republican.
Yes, and he wants all those children, all those 40 million babies that Tom DeLay talked about, because we need the cheap labor. And, you know, you think about it, we need locked-up children, too, because that's profit as well. See, I mean, this whole thing about contraception is just nuts to me. And it really is one of those things that That's just insane. I think, and I'm hoping, I really am hoping, that the women in this country, their eyes open up and go, oh my God, there's a party in this country that wants me to go back to the 90s, the 1890s, barefoot, pregnant, subservient. I'm hoping that light bulb goes on. I'm hoping that moment, that epiphany happens, because, you know, it's been something that's been in the works for years. These are the exact same forces who fought vehemently against the ERA back in the 70s, fought vehemently about, you know, equal rights, fought vehemently against Lilly Ledbetter. These are the same folks, the same forces. And I look at McConnell, this view that he was on with Bob Schieffer this past weekend, and, you know, came right out and said, look, I think any employer should be able to deny birth control. They should be able to do pretty much whatever it is that they want. And this bill that Senator Roy Blunt from Missouri is talking about, is putting out, is even going so far as to say that, well, an employer can decide other things as well. You know, what other type of services, because it's so wide, it's so vague, there's so many loopholes in it that it could really allow any employer to exclude any health service because, you know what, I have a moral obligation to it. And I look at this and I'm, you know, my head goes back, you know, to the good old days, back to the 90s, the 1890s, before workers actually had rights, when you were just when as a nation we admitted you were just tools, when we admitted you could just be used up and thrown away. Before there was workers' compensation or unemployment or anything, there was just desperation. And I truly believe they want to take us back to the days of the desperation class, where children go back to work in the mines and the looms. They go and work out in the fields. I mean, you've got Gingrich running around saying they should be cleaning the bathrooms. Get rid of those union janitors and put the kids in there. You know, never mind having to teach them to read. We put those pictures on the bottle with the skull and crossbones. They can just look at the pictures. Kids like pictures anyway. That seems to be where they're taking us. And, you know, last week I talked for a brief couple minutes to a right-winger at the CPAC thing, and, you know, the Lochner era came up. And I think he was surprised that I had actually read about it or anybody knew about it. But, you know, understand that period in history, when the Bake Shop Act was overturned and ruled unconstitutional, and they were able to throw out the maximum hour laws in New York. This is back in 1905 to 1900. The decision was in 1910. But in 1905, they said, hey, we think there should be a maximum number of hours that workers work in food service industries. So we're gonna cap it at 60 hours. Well, this guy said, no, I want people working longer than that. And when he got fined, he fought it. And the moneyed forces were behind him. And I see the same type of forces going on right now. That when the billionaire class is funding this right-wing movement, do you really think it's because they care if two guys are kissing? Do you think they really care if two girls are holding hands? No. It's about profit. It's about putting money in their pocket. It's about tearing down rules and regulations. It's about benefiting them. It has nothing to do with, you know, I really do not believe it's about their moral compass. Because if you would look at the things that they do around the world, moral compass, really? So when I think about this, you know, I go back to that era of the Lochner era, where every infringement on the so-called liberty of contract, that's the agreement that that an employee has with the master. They didn't use employer back there. It was an employee-master relationship. So whatever you made, whatever that agreement was, that was it. If you said, yes, you can beat my kids, that's what it was. Yes, you can have sex with my wife, absolutely. Yes, you can fire me anytime you want. The law didn't get involved in it. So there were no protections for working people. There were no protections at the bottom of the scale. And the farther down the socioeconomic ladder you went, the more desperate it became. And the more desperate you became. And the worse the scenarios were. And you go back and you learn, you read about all the things that we did. There was just a story not too long ago in North Carolina where they were sterilizing people. Because we decided that they weren't really smart enough. There's stories in the South where they were actually infecting people with STDs because we just wanted to see what would happen. This is what the billionaire class does. It's not so much about us. It's about them playing games. It's just a game to them. And to take us back to the days, and I believe this is the beginning of this. If my employer can tell me, sorry, I'm going to step between you and your doctor, and you can't have birth control or you can't have a certain surgery because, hey, you know what? We don't believe in stem cell research. And, oh, by the way, you know, that back injury you've got that could be healed with it, sorry, we don't believe in that. Or if you have leukemia, sorry, we can't use those stem cells to help with leukemia treatment. Sorry, don't believe in it. That's the kind of power we're giving up. That's the kind of power we're ceding to a handful. And if we go back to that, what does that mean for people who work for a living? And what does it mean for health insurance? Maybe there's part of me that says maybe that's a good thing. Maybe we destroy it, we take it out of the hands of employers. Maybe at some point we wake up and go, you know what? We don't want employers getting us health care. We want to do it for ourselves. And maybe we'll do it as a community. Maybe we'll do it in a style that, like most of the industrialized nations of this world, that covers everybody for a lot less money. And we take it out of the hands of big business. We take it out of the hands of these people who want to manipulate the system to make sure that they can fill their pockets. And that's what this is about. It's about filling their pockets. Now, I mean, the Catholic Church, they've got a handful of the people at the top, the minority up at the top. I believe they truly are offended by this. They're upset. They're angry because 95% of their women in their congregation are using it anyway, and they can't stop it. So there's part of me that goes, yeah, this minority up there, they want to use the law. They want to use the government. They want to use that power to make sure that they can hold their people in check, that they can hold these folks in line and make sure that, well, we're going to tell you what to do, and we have the power to enforce it by making sure that if you work in any industry that we have anything to do with, you won't get it. I understand the Catholic Church, lots and lots of holdings across this country. You'd be amazed, as I was. How far into our lives are they going to get? And McConnell talks about the rights of the minority, because the Constitution guarantees minority rights. And he's right. What about the minority? What about the minority who want it? And what about the majority who want it? Nobody is telling those bishops up at the top, nobody's telling them that they have to take it. Nobody. That, to me, would be an infringement. If we said, you know what, we're gonna make you take it. Like we were talking about back in the 90s. And if you remember that, you know, the whole, when Norplant first came out, the little capsule they shoot in your arm, they were talking about, oh, we could mandate all of those welfare people, all those people who don't have jobs, just lay around and pop out kids all the time. Pretty much the exact thing that the radical right is trying to tell people to do, because we seem to have it in our head that go forth and be fruitful. And when you do, they don't want any part of it. I mean, it's just it's amazing to me. You look at China, like I talked about before. The one-child policy. The right is just nuts about this. Just absolutely nuts. And how can you, I mean, how do you deal with a situation where you have overpopulation? I mean, how do you deal with that? I mean, I know how the righties would deal with it. They would ban birth control, and they would ban any education and preach abstinence. See, you should just not do it. And that would not work, as it hasn't worked. And it's not going to work. And this whole thing, you know, taking me back to McConnell's statement that employers should be able to deny it. What else can they deny? I mean, if that's the case, if we're going to give them that kind of power, what else will they be able to deny us? Safe working conditions? Minimum wage? Maximum hour laws? Overtime? What else can they deny us? Weekends? Vacations, what else are they going to deny? They're already working at taking most of those things back. They're already working at weakening and destroying those laws as we speak. So explain to me, you know, what more? What more can they take? Because I see this as very dangerous. If you're making this precedent that employers can make that decision on what you get and what you don't, it's dangerous. Now, for me, from an employment standpoint, I think health care is part of your wage. It's part of your benefits. At least that's what they keep telling us. And every time you go sit down at a bargaining table, anytime a union goes down and talks about wages and compensation, the first thing they throw out is, well, healthcare costs are killing us, so we can't give you monetary salary raises or hourly raises because our healthcare is eating that all up. So which is it? Is it not mine? Is it theirs? I mean, is it the employer's healthcare? Or is it mine that I'm paying for through deferred compensation, through a different form of compensation? And this is the thing that I haven't heard a lot of other people talk about yet. I'm a firm believer in, you know what, that's part of my wage package. And I go back to the building trades model. Maybe we just start charging, you know, if you're making $10 an hour and $5 an hour of it was health care, you just pay me $15 an hour and I'll go get health care through a union or through an association or through some other way. Maybe that's the way to go. Because I am really a big fan of not having the employer hold my health insurance. Big fan of that. Because they can manipulate. They can do things like this, which I think is destructive and it's going to tear us down. But you know what? They're going to hold on to whatever they can use to control us, whatever it is they can use to screw us over. And that's what I see this. And the fervor that you're seeing from the radical right, and it's only a handful of people. What I'm amazed at, I don't see many women out in the forefront of this. I see very few women out talking about, oh, we need to stop contraception. I think they get it. And if they haven't yet, I think they're going to. And I'll tell you, this weekend at my house, like I said before, this weekend at my house was a conversation of my wife having a grand moment. She's not political. She's really not. I'm political enough for the both of us. But at this moment, she's going, whoa, wait a minute. This is getting out of hand. You know, first the Komen thing and now this. You know, how many assaults on women and their rights do we have to endure? How much are we going to give up? How far does this go? And I've told you time and time again, this goes taking us all the way back before women really had rights. I mean, if they can go back and they can undo Roe versus Wade, they can undo Griswold, who's to say that we just don't go back and take voting rights away? I mean, there's no telling. Now, I don't think it'll get that far because it is constitutional, but don't give them any ideas. Don't give the Santorums any ideas. Don't give the radical right any ideas, because you know what? They may just take you up on it. And I look at this as just such nonsense. But it's a fight that has to be fought. And I guess now better than never. Let's take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science book. Don't know much about the French I took, but I do know that I need you. And if you fall for all the crap I spew, what a wonderful world this would be.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner error, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standard Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So like I said earlier, budget day today, and here to talk about what went on, our Victoria Jones Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, indeed. A lot of people talking about the budget. From the president on down, he started the day off at Northern Virginia Community College, and he was talking there because there's a big focus on education. He was talking about what we need to do, he said, in terms of higher education and community colleges in particular, because they had a big push today in their budget talks about how important it is to invest in education, not just from the point of view of getting everybody a good education, but because they want to be everybody to be able to get good jobs, and he talked specifically about that. But he also said that the budget that we're releasing today is a reflection of shared responsibility. And he said if we're serious about investing in our future and investing in community colleges and investing in new energy technology and basic research, well, we've got to pay for it, and that means we've got to make some choices. And he talks about some of the difficult choices, but he went on to say, I don't need a tax break. We don't need to be providing additional tax cut for folks who are doing really, really, really well.
Yeah, and I know when you're talking about community college, you're talking about kids going to college. The image that popped into my head is Mr. Sweater Vest himself, saying, "What elitist snobbery! He wants kids to go to college. How dare he?" And I'm thinking, that's the Republican line. It's
right.
We want kids to go to college. It's snobbery. I mean, Gingrich would have them cleaning toilets. They don't need to read. We put pictures on the bottles.
There you go.
But, and I look at this, and he's right. We need to invest in it. We need to pay for it. Here in the state of Pennsylvania, we got a governor who thinks she can cut 30% from higher ed, and kids are still going to be able to go to college.
Huh. How are they going to do that?
The same way that we're going to grow the economy by cutting social programs and kicking people off of food stamps and off of unemployment. Same thing.
I was going to get editorial there for a minute, but I won't.
Feel free.
Well, I was going to say that, sometimes Republicans say that the Democrats are turning the country into Greece, but that sounded like a Republican prescription for turning the country into Greece.
Yeah, but it is. I mean, this whole austerity thing, that's the gig. And there's part of me that says, let's say they did win come November. I guarantee they turn it back around. They start spending like drunken sailors.
Well, that's what's so interesting. It doesn't always exactly work that way. One of the things that was so interesting about the budget briefing that I was just at, with four of the president's policy wonks, was they kept mentioning, when they were pushed on the fact that, you know, president had promised in 2009 that he would halve the deficit by the end of his first term, and he hasn't done it, was how much worse things were when he came in than he'd realized, how they were hemorrhaging hundreds of thousands of jobs every month. But they kept hammering away at the 2001 and 2003, I think it was, Bush tax cuts and the Medicare Prescription D that wasn't paid for, that none of these things were paid for.
And not to mention the two wars. I mean, all
of
that money.
Interesting? They chose not to mention that.
Yeah, well, he's kind of bought it a little bit. But
still, well, and he does fight wars.
Yeah, well, and even still, I mean, we're talking a ton of money that could have been better spent.
Yeah.
And we could have built roads and bridges, and I understand the president's budget has some money in it to maybe start investing in infrastructure, since we really haven't for the last 30 years.
Well, they have plans for infrastructure in this budget. They have a number of plans. They have a six-year, $476 billion surface transportation reauthorization bill, expanded to include intercity passenger rail, so I can tell you right now that's going nowhere,
yeah,
to create thousands of new jobs and modernize a critical foundation of our economic growth. And I am reading right now from the federal budget fiscal year 2013. This is the White House document. Now, they say this will be fully paid for. How? Through current user finance mechanisms, and they also plan to use part of the savings from ending the war in Iraq and winding down operations in Afghanistan.
Yeah, but here's the thing. You know, at the end of this, you're right. The Republicans are going to block, delay. They're going to. Some of this stuff is not going to happen. That's why I think in November people have to say, what do I want? What kind of a nation do I want? Do I want crumbling roads and bridges? Do I want infrastructure that's failing? Do I want Thomas Friedman's assessment of our transportation, where he came from Beijing to LAX, said it was like coming from the Jetsons to the Flintstones? Is that what we want? I think not.
Probably not.
I hope not. But I'm sure the shiny thing in the room, gay marriage and contraception and all the other nonsense that we've been fed for the last 20, 30 years, I'm sure that's what we're going to focus on instead. Until we can't get to the polls, until the roads and the bridges are potholed and decrepit and we can't get to the polls, maybe then we'll change our mind. What else was in the grand budget?
Well, there's a call for tax reform. Number of pieces come to it. One of the parts of it is proposing that the decades old widely criticized tax category called the alternative minimum tax, which was adopted in 1969 to target wealthy Americans who pay little or no taxes, be overhauled and got rid of. Now, the AMT was never indexed for inflation, so it began hitting increasing numbers of middle class taxpayers who had accumulated too many deductions and credits. So that led Congress to enact a lot of temporary fixes. Well, the idea is that the Buffett rule would replace it. Because the Buffett rule, which we've heard of because Warren Buffett said the government was coddling the super rich, will be this idea of a 30% tax on incomes of more than $1 million.
So will Mitt Romney get a 16.1% tax increase?
Yes, he most certainly would, and it would do other things. It calls for taxing long-term capital gains at 20% for upper-income Americans, taxing dividends as ordinary income for wealthier taxpayers instead of the 15% top tax rates. Now, it also calls, also targets hedge fund managers and private equity partners who currently pay a 15% capital gains rate on carried interest, which is something also that Mr. Romney has benefited from. Carried interest is the share of profits from an investment fund or partnership given to managers as compensation. And Mr. Obama's plan would tax these profits at ordinary income rates, raising $13 billion over 10 years. In other words, they'd say it's income. You're making money as though it's a salary. It's not carried interest. Get over it. The oil and gas industry is coming into the crosshairs. Mr. Obama called for excluding energy companies from a tax break that's aimed broadly at domestic manufacturing, and he also proposed abolishing a method of inventory accounting favored by oil companies.
Interesting. But I've never understood why, you know, sitting on my yacht or sitting poolside collecting dividend checks was taxed at a different rate from the guy who's actually cleaning the pool or sailing the yacht. I think income should be income, and that should be it. This idea that we give preferential treatment to the very wealthy because we want them to invest money, because we somehow think if the tax rate's, well, the same as me working for it, that they won't, is nonsense.
Indeed.
The payroll tax, last line I've got for you, the payroll tax. Any movement on this? I know it's the end of the month. We've still got time for the ticking time bomb to go off. The cliff is still a little bit ahead of us, and the Republicans, I'm sure, will drive us right up to it.
Well, it's fascinating because they really would like to get some kind of deal on something today because, first of all, next week is a write-off because it's the President's Day recess all week, unless Senate leaders turn around and say, whoa, hold your horses, you're not going anywhere, which they might do if there's no progress. Problem is, Max Baucus, Democrat, and Dave Camp, Republican, who are heads of two big committees, were trading offers all weekend and got nowhere. And tomorrow, House Republicans plan to bring a plan to the House floor. That's going to complicate things because that will create a lot of bad blood. And once you've got something on the House floor, it's like, well, there's a plan. Meantime, Senate Democrats are caucusing tomorrow at their lunch, and they will likely bring a plan to the floor, maybe Wednesday or late Tuesday. So then you've got another plan, and you've got competing plans. Meantime, you've got these 20 conferees trying to work something out. They actually are trying. They're just getting nowhere. So it's all getting really nasty, and you've got aides walking around saying, well, he doesn't want to work anything out because he doesn't want a deal. Well, he doesn't want to work anything out because it's better for him politically, and it's all really awful.
It is awful, and I think the worst part of it is what you just said. It doesn't work for him politically, or it works too well for him politically. Instead of saying, you know what, there are millions of people in this country who their unemployment benefits are going to run out, and they're not going to be able to put food on the table. Or, you know, hey, the couple of bucks that's going to go into every working person's pocket is going to help continue to help our economy move forward. you just throw up your hands sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's all about getting your pet project. And I look at this Keystone XL thing. They're going to attach that to whatever they can to get it through.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, Victoria. Always great to talk with you. I appreciate the time.
Good to talk to you.
I'm Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break right back after this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
On June 25, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as race raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
I do think it's time for a change, but the question is what kind of change? You look at what our governor's doing here in this state, and it's change. But it's not good change. And I look at the tweet of the day from PAGOP, who, you know, says the budget proves Governor Corbett's commitment to public education by keeping the best educators in Pennsylvania. Responsibility. I'm going, wait a minute. So you got rid of 14,000 teachers and support staff. You're cutting the budget again this year, which is going to be more job losses, more teachers out the door. And somehow that's a commitment to public education. That's kind of nuts to me. But, you know, hey, the assault continues. Maybe, you know, kids have set classes with 70 kids and a teacher who's making 20 grand a year. Maybe that's a commitment to education in the GOP world. Maybe that's what it is. You know, in the grand obstructionist party's view, maybe that is what education should be. And, you know, I look at Arizona, where the assaults continue. Evidently, they have proposed a piece of legislation, Senate Bill 1467, that states that educators at these states' public schools and universities can be fined and ultimately fired if they engage in speech or conduct that would violate the standards adopted by the Federal Communications Commission concerning obscenity, indecency, and profanity. If that speech or conduct broadcast over television or radio. So, you know, especially in college, because I had professors who, you know, for emphasis sake, they would, you know, hey, they'd say something that little off color. You're adults at that point, 18 and above. Sorry, not buying it. But what they're talking about doing is banning books. I mean, this is really the end of the thought era. This is really going back to the book burning days. And the people over at Think Progress said, you know, well, here are some examples of what this law would end up doing. The dictionary would be outlawed. No dictionary, because the dictionary has some swear words in it. Slaughterhouse-Five, Catcher in the Rye, Canterbury Tales, Night Runner, whole bunch of you know, classic books, gone. Which is, yeah, if I remember right, 1984 had a couple of off-color words that, you know, would catch the anger of the righties. And I go, you know, it's kind of dumb that you would do this. Now, look, you know, I understand, you know, you don't want Catcher in the Rye or those books in third grade classes. Okay, I get it. But, you know, high school, college, yeah, come on. But to me, what it tells me, again, you know, they want to control everything. They want to control their children's thoughts. They want to control society to be this puritanical neverland, something that has never been and never will be, pining for a day when we were all religious zealots and prim and proper. Sorry, wasn't that way. Never happened. Nice stories. You can think about it. Not going to happen. Human nature is what it is. And, you know, this assault on education, this assault on reason, this assault on critical thinking, to me, is dangerous. It's going to put this country in a world of hurt. And the more we spend time on issues that are just dumb, the longer it's going to take for us to get back on our feet. The shorter time till we're no longer the world superpower. Understand, the Chinese, they get it. They're investing heavily in their country. The Indians get it. They're investing heavily in their country. The Russians get it. They're pairing up with the Chinese. We better, while we're playing around in the sandbox and we're arguing over how much money we should be giving wealthy people, and while we're all distracted, they're organizing. They're coming together. They understand it. And they're buying us. They're buying up our natural resources. This pipeline thing, do you think this pipeline is going to, the Keystone XL is going to benefit us? I'm not against it because I think it's horrible for the environment. I think we could have some bad effects. I mean, we've got pipelines going all over the place. I just don't think it's going to help us. So why put the country in the middle of another potential disaster if it's not going to help us? And I just don't think it is. But that's what the righties want. And I guess they're going to get their way one way or another. And our last story of the day comes from Florida. This is one of the gun nuts, the righty gun nuts. They got to have our guns in church. Well, it happened. Some nitwit brought his gun to church. I was in the cloakroom showing it off when, guess what? It went off. Shot a 20-year-old girl in the back of the head who didn't see it coming. Turns out it was the pastor's daughter. She is in critical condition, and their prayers are going out for her so that hopefully the swelling goes down on her brain. But it's not, doesn't look good according to reports. No charges filed. Why? He had a permit, and he didn't break any laws. I'm going, really? Didn't break any laws? Discharging a firearm, not breaking any laws? Sad, sad stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download the podcast. If you got a smartphone, make sure you get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. Again, questions, comments, something on your mind. If I ticked you off, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. See you tomorrow.